The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey everybody, before you get into the show, which I know you're super excited to hear because every fucking show of Thinking Outside the Long Box is amazing, we want to thank our Patreon supporters, Chad, Ryan, Derek, Doyle, Devin, Taylor, Jason, Steve, and now Christine. Thank you so much for being a part of this show by donating to us on Patreon. If you too would like to support this show and keep it going every other week after every other week, then you can go to patreon.com/TOTLB where you can get your choice of all sorts of cool bonus videos and awesome prizes like hats and t-shirts, original sketches. I don't know if you guys follow Tim Husky's artwork on Instagram, but one of those original sketches got colored and it was fucking amazing. So join us today at patreon.com/TOTLB. And to those of you who are already subscribed, thank you so much. We appreciate you more than our own assholes. All right, guys, back on the show. We have Pamela Ribbon. You have done a ton of different things, but for me personally, I'm super excited because you created Slam, which is the roller derby comic book.
Yeah, thank you.
So the question I have to start out with is, you've written for TV,
multiple televisions
all at once, TV, movies, comics, theater, as a columnist. Mm-hmm. Which media do you find like the most satisfying to write for?
Well, they all deal with different levels of collaboration. So it's kind of how many people do I want to talk to today about this story? But it's actually, it is true. That's what I enjoy about it. Sometimes it's something I'm doing kind of by myself or maybe with a handful of people. And then sometimes it's a giant world building situation where you have hundreds and hundreds of people working on it. And that's a lot of fun too.
That would be crazy. Like, I can't imagine, like, the level of involvement that it takes to say, I wrote this thing, and now, like, hundreds of people are going to touch it for, like, a television show or, like, a movie or something. Like, can that be kind of overwhelming?
I suppose it could be overwhelming in terms of the pace and the responsibility. But the fact is, every one of those people make it so much better than you could have ever even dreamed. You know what I mean? It's not even, like, at the level of your... It's not like... What am I trying to say here? They're so talented that they just plus everything over and over again. And
that's
so
awesome.
That responsibility is to be able to give someone exactly what they need to be able to take it and run with it and make it shine. So, and you have to do it very, very quickly. So that is the stressful part.
So tell me a little bit of the inspiration behind creating Slam.
Slam actually came about because Boom contacted me. My editor, Shannon Waters, contacted me and said, I'd love to do a roller derby book, and I've been following you for years, so I know you skate and that you're legit. And do you have any roller derby stories? And I had written a novel a few years ago called Going in Circles that was about roller derby, and I tried to set it up as a TV show and a few different networks. And at the time, it just wasn't, honestly, like one network said, I just don't feel like there are enough men in this story. can there be more male skaters? And I was like, there just cannot. Like, I'm so sorry. So when Boom said we'd love to do one, I said, well, they're not going to be what you normally see roller derby girls portrayed as in comics and movies. That's going to be more what it's really like. And she said, that's exactly what we're hoping for. So they found Veronica and Veronica Fish, who's the incredible artist in the first four issues. And we built this together. So
that's awesome. So my daughter skates derby. I actually coach.
What is her derby name?
Her derby name is Yuki. It's a snow ghost, and she named herself that because she's incredibly pale.
That's awesome. You coach?
I coach. Yeah, I'm the juniors coach for our local team.
See, this is how you get men in roller derby. Yeah. They coach. Yes, they have whistles
or reffing.
Yes,
whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So. She expressed, well, first of all, she told me to tell you she loves your book, mostly because she feels it's the most accurate portrayal of roller derby that she's ever seen. You know, she reads Trish Trash, which is Roller Girl of Mars, you know, which is, it's awesome and it goes over the rules and all that, but it takes place in Mars.
Yeah, it's
and
a fantasy,
they
yes.
ride like laser skates, right. You know, you know, she's read Fast Track Furies, you know, mm-hmm. which has like a little bit of an adventure element to it and that sort of stuff. So she really appreciates like how realistic it is.
You've drawn from your experience as a skater, like, you know, what was it like being able to translate, like, your personal experience as a skater into something?
Roller derby, you know, it's almost a cliche saying right now, but roller derby saved my life, right? I found it at a time that everything was really hard in my life. And to be able to go somewhere, drop your name and everything that's going on in your life and work on something that's so hard, you can't think of anything else. You really can't. It's so hard. And in doing so, you're meeting all these other women and you don't, or girls in your daughter's case, and you don't know anything about them, but what they bring to the track. And there's something about that that really rebuilds your soul and shows you the best of what humans do together. To be able to tell stories like that, to show that roller derby is a sport. And you know, I didn't actually get to play a lot of sports growing up, so this was new to me too, like building teams and relying on like a group of women. I just didn't have this in my life before. And so any way that I could give back to the sport that helped me, that's again, the pace and the responsibility there was to what it's really like to give this kind of time. You give your life over to derby. It takes every second that you will give it. And then it also sucks in all of your friends and family.
Yeah, correct.
It's like, yeah, it's just derby, derby, derby.
My youngest daughter now skates. She's 7.
Yeah.
And like my wife has become like the interleague coordinator and I'm the coach and yeah. You know, everybody, I forced my son to volunteer at the concession stand. You know, I mean, yeah. Like it sucks in everybody.
You genuinely fall in love with it. That's it. I don't know a lot of things that you watch that happen to someone. They look at their bodies differently. They think of food differently. They think of their friends differently. And then they take those skills and they use them in real life. And that was kind of what I wanted to show in Slam as well. Like what you think you're doing just by like skating laps actually becomes what makes you ask for that promotion or take that step in, you know, take a leap of faith in love.
So most important question that I missed, what was your skate name?
Oh, I'm Make You Holla, number $50.
That's awesome. When you first joined roller derby, you know, you said you were kind of in a tough place. Like what about it? Like, you know, that all consuming nature of it and the camaraderie, like what about it originally drew you into the sport though? Like, you had to have seen it somewhere or had someone invite you. Like what pulled you in the first place?
Well, I actually was training for 2 months before I ever saw one, but I did when I was little, I saw the roller derby that was on TV on WGN after GLOW. So I loved GLOW and then I loved the Fabulous like Thunderbirds, like, and that was all, you know, an offshoot of wrestling.
Right.
But it still really captivated me. And then, one day in LA, I went to go see the Sex and the City movie and my friend like gingerly sat down next to me and she said, "I'm sorry, I'm so sore. I started training with the Derby Dolls yesterday." And I went, "Wait, you can do that?" And I had seen the LA Derby Dolls on Anthony Bourdain's show and knew that they were out there somewhere, but I never would have thought that you could just walk into this warehouse and do this. And it turns out you could. And so I did. Like, I didn't know you were supposed to sign any paperwork at all. And they didn't realize that I had not been in the initial fresh meet group. I was just skating with some borrowed skates and then I never stopped going.
So the Derby Dolls are a bank track team,
yes,
correct?
Bank track, yes.
So have you skated flat track as well or?
Yes, I've done a little flat track because we tried to be bi-tractual. And there are more opportunities to skate flat track than there is bank track. I am not the best flat track skater. I'm just not. It's a different strategy. It's a different play set, and it does not speak to what I really enjoy about banked with the angles and the speed, and also the nature of the relationship to the audience in a bank track is different. There's a little more of that spectacle to it. I'm from Austin. I wasn't there during the revival of roller derby, but I've gone back and been on that track as well, and it's just a different. Like, there's something really fun to me, the do-it-yourself nature of roller derby and that old school revival of it is where my heart lies. I'm so excited about like skating with your real names and skating, you know, to be in the Olympics. I'm not an athlete. I'm a comedy writer.
Right.
So at one point I'm like, the sport is better than I will ever be. So I enjoy that there is a part of derby that says, oh, you don't have to be quote unquote an athlete. You just have to be tough and give this thing your
and
all.
Show up.
And show up and do your best. And you'll find your spot on the team.
That's awesome. when you're stating flat track versus bank track, you know, you're talking about the angles and stuff, and I know there's like a little bit of like a danger element to
yeah, a little bit.
To like, you know, you can really jack yourself up coming you sure off can. Of one of those banks. Like, did you ever have a moment where you're like, oh, this is nuts, like I should not be doing this?
Yeah, I fell off the track more than once. Shit. Like over the thing.
Top.
Yes. Not the top rail, but through and then over. But on the high side. And I've done that. Yeah, I have done that more than once. It is a moment when your brain goes, hey, let's talk about this. Let's talk about what we're doing. And yeah, sometimes you have an injury that takes you out. I tore my PCL. So I was out for about 6 months and didn't think I was going to go back. And then I did. And then I had a kid. I thought I wasn't going to go back. And then I did. So, this last time though, I almost fractured my jaw, and that would have been difficult to keep working without being able to speak.
Yeah, that would be no fun.
No.
So I'm going to move on a little bit. I'm super excited. I get to moderate the roller derby panel.
Oh, cool.
So like I'll get to ask more roller derby questions then. Yes. But for right now, I have to know, what's it like dipping your toe into the Rick and Morty universe?
It's such a fun sandbox, I will say. I'm thrilled that I get to work with Rick and Morty. You do have surprisingly a lot of freedom. It does go through Adult Swim, like they, and Justin, and they approve everything that we're doing. So it's not like off on your own. You can do whatever you want, but I really enjoy writing for characters in this world. They're so funny, and you can't believe what you get away with. There was a page I had to change that I'm still upset. They just said, this is, there's too many boobs on this page. Too many boobs. That's the line. I'm kind of proud of myself to have found the line in Rick and Morty.
Like,
who knew there was one?
Number line, number wise, what's too many? Like, how many was too many?
Let me tell you, I'm just going to go ahead and pitch it. It was like, this is okay, because I heard you say an S word, so I know I'm not being too dirty.
Yeah.
I was like, is this for kids? It was like Morty had this little scrapbook that he kept of pictures of boobs. And so one was like the self-exam for the mammogram from the doctor's office. And then one was like a bra catalog. And then there was one that was like a drawing he made of a dinosaur that had boobs. And then you see like a close-up of boobs, but then you see it's Morty taking pictures real close of a box of donuts. And then he's putting in the newest one of like donut boobs. And in the back, you can see Beth in the back of his room in the door looking at him so sad that she's discovered her son's booby book.
That's amazing.
And too many boobs, they said. So it's gone.
Oh, man. I really, really wish that would have stayed in. That's amazingly funny. Because I know we're probably getting pretty close to having to wrap up.
Okay.
Like, what projects are you currently working on? Like, you know, where are you going from here?
I've been for the past couple of years co-writing the Wreck-It Ralph sequel, Ralph Breaks the Internet. That comes out Thanksgiving of this
Super
year.
Super excited for, by the
so
way.
Very
I love
exciting.
That movie.
Thank you. Yeah, I can't wait for everybody to see this level of craziness. And I'm working on a couple of comic books that are not announced yet, but I'll be doing some stuff there.
Awesome. Can you announce like what companies you're working with?
I'm
like,
working with Boom and Oni again. Yeah,
awesome.
I really
Very
like
cool.
working with both of those. Oh, I have a new book called My Boyfriend is a Bear that just came out with Oni Press. Kat Ferris is the illustrator. It's about a girl named Nora who dates a 500-pound American black bear. He's super good at cuddling. He came down because of some fires, and she's had just a string of crappy boyfriends. And this guy is the best. Like, the bear, like, helps her out in the house. He's a real bear. Like, he doesn't speak, but he does wear her ex-boyfriend's Arcade Fire t-shirts so that they can go out and do things. They can't go to the zoo or Runyon because everybody's like, that's a bear, but they can go to the Grove because everyone's on their phones. And, you know, it's about that time when you have been dating for a little while and it's time for everyone to meet your friends and whether or not they like accept your love. And then he has to hibernate. So will they survive long distance? Like, they're like, Nora, that's like, it's like a real fucking bear at brunch. Like, what are you doing? But they're in love.
That's so amazing. So I know I don't have a ton of time, but like, where do you come up with like crazy ideas like that? Or do you just like write little notes to yourself when something makes you chuckle? Or
yeah, I guess Well, I guess that is, that makes me sound like I just sit around and like, oh, I've done it again. That's not how it works.
Wait,
at all.
That's how I do it. That's not how you do it.
I'm really proud of you.
I'm so funny.
I don't know. You have an actual muse. And you're like, it's pot. I smoke pot. And then I'm like, that's hilarious. But yeah.
Don't tell my secrets. Don't tell my trade secrets.
You're the only one. No one's figured this out yet. I was dating a guy. I'd sat down with Oni Press and with Charlie Chu, who was my editor on this, and he liked this pilot script that I had written, but I was still trying to turn it into a TV show. And I said, well, then let me tell you, I do think this guy I'm dating might be a bear. He finds all my good snacks no matter where I hide them. Sometimes he takes his jacket off to smoke a cigarette and he hangs that jacket on a tree. I don't even know. Like, I'm either dating Huckleberry Finn or a giant bear. And Charlie was like, go on. And so that was it, because he traveled a lot and I just started thinking about it. And one time after he had left, he went, like, got on a plane and took off, and it was so quiet in my apartment, and he texted, it's like the zoo goes to sleep when I'm gone. And I was like, it is. It sounds like the zoo is asleep.
That's awesome.
That's where that book came from.
So how can our listeners find you on social media or however they can get in contact with you or keep up with your work?
I'm Twitter. I'm at Pamela Ribbon. That's R-I-B-O-N. You will see an ongoing joke that no one ever gets my name correct. So thank you. Yeah. You nailed it first try.
I even have it written down in my notebook, right?
Yes, look at that. You do. It's spelled correctly. I'm also Pamela Ribbon at Instagram, but that's nothing but like Morty's booby book. Like, that's really what I use Instagram for.
Oh my God, I'm definitely going there.
My Instagram is mostly terrifying. I'm really afraid of dolls, and my daughter has some, and she just leaves them in places doing things that scare me. I round a corner, and there's a scary doll about twice a day.
Nice.
So that's mostly what. So if you're afraid of doll, trigger warning on my Instagram feed. It's a legit trigger warning. I can't go there anymore.
And that's it's your own page, and you're like, oh,
so
fuck that, I'm out.
It's true. You have to go, you have to do what scares you, right? or is it art? Like, no, Pam, that's not what that means.
You literally don't have to terrify yourself. It's okay.
I'll never learn. I have a book called Notes to Boys. It's about how I used to write letters to boys in high school, including 200-page letters, and I kept all the first drafts. So I do have a book that you could read of all my now-published first draft love letters to boys throughout high school.
Oh, wow. That sounds amazing.
Well, yeah, and I'm going back, and it's me now, like, talking to young me then, because I clearly set myself up for failure. Like, at 13, all I wanted as a mature woman was to find a boy who would sit and watch broadcast news with me all day long. Those were hard to find.
Yeah.
But I didn't stop trying.
Exist.
No. I don't know.
I'm going to need you to be a CNN junkie real bad.
Yeah. I don't know. Sometime. And anyway, and then I dip my toe in erotica, but I'm so clearly a virgin that I created a new form of literature called awkwardica. And those are in those pages as well. So yes, I don't know.
Awesome.
That's the thing I wrote down. Like, what if I publish a bad idea? Like, that was it.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'm
thank
super
you.
Excited to do the panel with you too,
because yeah,
this
Thanks
should be
so
super
much.
Engaging.
Yeah, this is going to be great. This
awesome.
Is awesome. Thank you.
So it's 5 o'clock, so we're going to go ahead and get started. Everybody, my name is Gabe, but for this panel, you guys can call me Lunchbox. That is my derby name as the coach of my daughter's junior team in Greeley. And I just want to start off by having you guys introduce yourselves with your derby names. Yeah, let's go for it. Yeah, what you do, like, and all that sort of stuff.
Hey, everyone, how's it going?
Your mic's not on.
It's a really sensitive button.
Whoa.
Sorry.
It was exciting.
My name is Mariah Hummer, and my derby name is the original Skankster. Everyone calls me the Skank, it's a whole thing. And I skate for Denver Roller Derby. I've been skating for about 6 years. I also do a comic in my free time called Flat Track Furies, and it's just about a team of roller derby girls that, you know, fight monsters and crime, and all the main characters are women or girls, and they just kind of get into
it. Ah,
Hi, my name is Pamela Ribbon. My derby name is Make You Holla. I skated off and on with the Los Angeles Derby Dolls. I have a comic called Slam about two girls who get drafted from Fresh Meat to rival teams in their league and how to stay best friends when you have to also be competitors. I also work and write in some other comics, and I write at Disney Animation for some features, but Slam is what I'm here to talk about.
Did I push this? Or no, it's already on. Cool.
Maybe back there.
Hey, my name's Salty Beach. I just moved to Denver, so I just started skating with Denver Roller Derby. It's a cool league, so I'm super stoked to be part of that. In my kind of other life, I work for various comic shops, and I'm a queer health advocate and master's student.
I'm Kat Lay. I'm one of the writers for Lumberjanes. I wrote a roller derby arc for Lumberjanes. I also did a variant cover for Slam, and I'm just a big roller derby fan, so I don't have a name.
Yet. I think it's Kat Slay, though. I mean, just...
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Oh. That's a good one.
Hi, I'm Tatum. My roller derby name is Satisfied. If you are in my family, then you will totally understand that. But so I skate for the Boulder County Bombshells. They're the junior league of, I see someone knows of them, and they're the junior league of the Boulder County Bombers. And recently, there was an electrical fire, and our entire barn burned down. So, and it melted the track, so they're just finishing up a fundraiser to rebuild it. Right now. So. Memories. Memories have escaped with that barn. No, seriously, I can't remember anything that happened in that barn.
So what we'll do is I'll get started with a few of my own questions for these guys, and then while I'm doing that, be thinking of your own questions, and then I'll warn you when it's going to be your turn. So so I guess my first, like, really general question is, what has your experience with roller derby been? Like, just in general.
Are we just going
in? However you want to go, it doesn't matter.
Okay, cool. So I think the first experience I had with roller derby, my husband's friend that he went to high school with, she invited us to her first bout, and so we went, and it was at this roller rink in Fort Collins, and we just kind of fell in love with it. So I skated with Fort Collins for about 3 years, and I skated with Boulder for about 2 years, and I had just transferred to Denver, so I've mostly been a skater. I've reffed a little bit. I've been like a non-skating official a little bit, but mostly I've just been like in the thick of it, I guess.
I watched roller derby when I was growing up because it was on after the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, and that was a very important hour in my forming of my feminist ideals. And when I found out that you could skate with the LA Derby Dolls, I just showed up. I did not know you were supposed to sign a lot of paperwork or have two forms of insurance. I just started skating, and again, like, you fall in love with it, and that's it. I, in fact, was training for my first bout for about 2 months before I ever saw what one looked like. I thought I should probably see what's going to happen to me.
I started skating after I met some folks from Denver Roller Derby while I was here for a conference. I met them in the airport, and they were so cool. I was like, I got to figure out how I can do this. I found a team back home in North Carolina where I was at the time, and just started skating. I went through the Fresh Meat program. That was super fun, and just found a wicked cool community there, and there's really nothing like it.
Like I said, I'm a fan. I went to my friend's rookie season, Cuban Missile, in Chicago, which is a huge city for roller derby. They've got loads of teams. And it was the first time I saw a sport that really celebrated women and different body types specifically. Like, every body type was celebrated and necessary for the team. And I love puns. And so the names are great, and also, obviously, there's a lot of just queerness to the sport that's celebrated instead of pushed under the rug like some other women's sports.
So I kind of found out about derby and just fell in love with it as soon as I read the first chapter of Roller Girl. I was just like, oh my word, can I please start this? Where do I sign up? So immediately I was just like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Oh my gosh. Wow. So I eventually went to a Boulder County Bombers bout without knowing, because my dad had taken me there. And he also took my brother, yes, Boone, you, and my other friend Declan. And so my dad gave us a hint, and the hint is from Roller Girl. And it was, we're going to a night of cultural enlightenment. And if you remember, Astrid's mom takes her and her friend Nicole to a lot of nights of cultural enlightenment, quote unquote. So, and we didn't even consider that my dad worked for a pop culture classroom. Hello? What? What's wrong with us? But my friend Declan, he remembered that there was a fairground, and that's where the bout was being held. So, yeah. That was, oh my gosh, that was so fun. I just saw people roller skating through the windows, and I was just like, Dad, have you brought us to a roller derby bout? And he just was quiet, and I was just like, yes, you have, haven't you? Get me in there! So, that's how I fell in love with derby.
So, as professionals that are creators, how do you feel like the complications of like the rule set of roller derby translate into like media? Like that is, I feel like when I first was introduced to the sport, it was very complicated, and it took probably like 3 months of watching YouTube to figure out what was actually going on.
Yeah.
Like how as creators do you translate like roller derby into comic?
It was funny, in Slam I realized I was at issue 4 before I had ever explained how derby works, and I threw in at that point, like when the news comes to do like, hey, we're with some real cool ladies, they're going to do some crazy stuff, like, the way that the news sometimes will talk about roller derby, and use that as a way to say like, these are the rules of hitting. And then each issue I had kind of a fundamental skill that you're trying to learn in derby, and then why that would be appropriate in life, like jumping the apex or things like that. So I built in the rules as you learned about the relationships and what you cared about someone learning that issue, so that you, because it's too overwhelming to learn right off the bat. As you know, like you watch it for a while and you start to get the hang of it. But the minute that you are, you know, you really only need to know the race at the beginning to root for it. I'm sorry. I they got here earlier, and I was like, I don't get this. And then paper showed up, and I'm like, you're rock, paper, scissors, and I love it. I love it.
Yeah. I spotted that yes. point, and I was just like,
so
wait,
great.
Where's paper?
Yay, rock, paper, scissors.
I've kind of chosen to ignore it a little bit, honestly. So I think that there are some aspects of the game that are really important, right? Like the competitiveness and, like Pam said, the race, and also like working together as a team. But I have one of the junior skaters on the team with the adults in my comic. I've just kind of chosen to ignore the fact that in real life they would never be on the same team. And it's just like an opportunity for like those skaters to kind of teach that skater different lessons in life and stuff. And so I think it's important to embrace the big rules, and the little ones I don't really think you need to worry about too much. So
I tried to keep it pretty simple in terms of explaining the rules. During the Lumberjanes arc, I had one of the main characters be a roller derby girl, you know, in her, you know, non-summer life. And so she explained the rules, and then if you haven't read the arc, the team that they're skating against are Sasquatches. So I didn't have to worry too much about keeping it perfect, but I was really careful. I read the rule book so many times, and I watched so many bouts on YouTube to make sure that I wasn't accidentally having anyone break the rules, because there are a few points where I like they call out specific penalties and things. So I knew that anyone that was reading it and was aware of the rules would be like, wait, they called a penalty on that, but not that. And so I was like, I did more research than actually shows up in the book. But I tried to be very careful about the rules without ever really explaining them too much.
And that was the
thing. Oh, okay. And you did. I mean, yes. Like, you nailed it. I mean, frankly, the Sasquatches are just sassy Sasquatches that are trying to take back a tree. So the art goes, local Yeti population loses their treehouse, and so they're unplugging. Was it the freezer?
Yeah, they were. It was.
Yeah, I think it was the ice cream freezer. And so just to charge their Walkman batteries, because they just love their Walkman, and they're, oh my gosh, it's funny. And then April, the strongest but, I'll have you know, smallest, she challenges the Sasquatches to a roller derby bout, and Mal's just like, oh yes, and Jen's like, oh no. And so eventually the Rumble Janes, which is their team name, they win, and winner takes it all, and yeah. So it was all for a power source, which Joe, the genius of the group, she got it, so yeah.
One of the things that Slam was, I wanted to be a derby comic for the derby community, and so attention to detail, but I wanted someone to be able to, if they picked it up and on any page were like, no, that's not, let's hit that, but even that's not what the pads look like, or that's not how we wear our helmets, and that helmet's on backwards, or mouth guards, like, it's really, that's the thing that Veronica and I went back and forth on the most, was me making sure, like, those socks look cute, but she would not, you know, just all the way down to shin guards on this one, and in Slam, the one thing I had to just let go was she had a name safety pin to the back a lot, and I was like, we would just never have safety pins that could, like, get in, but some things you would just have to let go. But, but yeah, it was really important to me that authenticity was a part of this, because Slam was all about derby life, and they weren't going to fight monsters or anything where I could get away with, like, we're in space, it's okay, so it had to stay pretty grounded.
Plus, if you know anything about derby, you know that the rule set changes, like, every year. So you can be as accurate as you want, and the WFTDA is going to come out with rule changes a year later. So it is what it is.
That's true.
Yeah. I think experience that being, at the beginning of the year is it can be, like, every 2 months. Yeah. So.
Yeah. I think all that being said, though, I did send a picture of your rules page to my mom.
Really?
When she was like, all right, so what actually is this? And I was like, I could send you a YouTube video or wait.
That's awesome. So, thanks.
I thought it was a really good, very helpful representation.
Yes. Thank you.
So sometimes people don't, like, really understand. Like, you say, okay, I skate roller derby, or I do a comic about roller derby, and they want more of an explanation. What's a source that you send people to? What do you say, hey, this is what I'm talking about? Like, is there a site or a book or something that you're directing people towards to learn about derby?
For me, it would be Victoria Jameson's Roller Girl. As I mentioned earlier, it's got this cute little cartoon of the rules, and it basically nails it. And the rule book is pretty simple, but it gets all the details, and it worked for me, so.
God. Oh, no, we might have the same
answer. I know, right. So I usually... people always have these, like, misconceptions about derby, and whenever they ask you, their question is always, oh, do you punch girls in the face and, like, throw bows and do all those things? I started just getting, like, a piece of paper and drawing out the track and, like, talking to people about it, and I got sick of doing that. So this year for Free Comic Book Day, I just made, like, a 6-page comic book, and it's just my character, like, Dora the Destroyer explains roller derby, and so I just carry them around in my backpack now. Like, that's just how it goes.
That is straight out genius.
That's really awesome.
I'm going to need one of those.
Yeah, I'm going to need one. Yes, please.
I think everyone here might take up on that.
Turn it like this. And then I play bank track. So it's like this.
You just take the corners and fold it. Yes. And
cup it. And so it's NASCAR. I have all of those things, right? It's NASCAR with ladies as cars. It's football without a ball. But Whip It is a great film. It's not exactly how derby is played, but it is the spirit of why you fall in love with this, why you live two lives, why it's worth giving up all of your time, because it puts everything into your heart. And I thought that's a movie made for me. I'm from Austin. It was, you know, filmed on my track. It's got Radiohead in it. Like, I'm like, who else? This is a movie they made for me to watch. But it turns out some other people like it too. But Whip It for sure is
that's a
great one. Kansas City Bombers is the one you get a lot, right? Like, because it was the Raquel Welch, and that was like punch people in the face derby, and it's not really the right thing exactly.
How about you guys? Is there anything that you look at directly, or even for you, Kat, with your research going into creating your story arc, was there something that you looked at personally a lot, or?
Well, I'd already been a fan of the game long enough to have a good idea of the rules, but I wanted to. I mean, I read the rule book, which is really basic. I wouldn't recommend that to just a lay person to learn about the game. But I did watch a lot of bouts on YouTube that were not the televised 70s sensationalized roller derby, which is not accurate, but. You know, a lot of just national meets, and if you like go to a certain point, you'll skip all the chat beforehand, and you'll just see how the game is played, and that's pretty good, I think.
Did you have something, Salty, that you're kind
of? If you've never seen an old program called Roller Games. It is almost exactly nothing like roller derby, but I think it really gets at the spirit of it a little bit. There's a alligator pit and a half pipe and a big jump. So I think while you could look at that and think like, you know, look, we can talk about like how to explain the rules, but like if you really want to show a family member at Thanksgiving, like, this is what I do, and kind of freak them out a little bit. Nothing like an alligator pit on wheels. Like, roller games is the one for you.
So you can find it on YouTube, because as I was getting ready to research this, I looked up like some stuff like that, and roller games popped up. They're incredible to watch. They skate a figure eight track that has a jump with an alligator pit. They punch each other, they elbow each other. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, like, the rules are nothing like roller derby, but like the competitive spirit is there.
What rules? they never even explain how points are scored. Like, it's insane. And that actually leads to, this is actually my last question, so be ready with some questions, please, so that it doesn't go super short. So how do you feel about the roots of the sport? From bank tracks, which you have skated, but most people are skating flat tracks, to the wrestling style promos and things like roller games and like the ridiculous like rule sets in roller games, to the state of flat track derby today and like kind of the way it's represented in popular media. How do you guys feel about that?
That's a big question. I know.
I like a lot of the aesthetic of, like you were saying, like the televised roller derby and like glow. I like that aesthetic, and I like the bits of that that are kept by modern roller derby. But I also I know a lot of derby girls who are like they want it to be taken as a serious sport because they are serious about it and they're serious athletes. And that's been my experience mostly. It's like people definitely have fun with it. Like. The makeup, and my friend's going to RollerCon in Vegas next month, I think, and there are a lot of like people there that teach you like war paint, and I think you know, some of the costumes are really great. Well, not costumes, but uniforms are great. Yeah, thank you. So I love the bits that are kept from kind of the more sensationalized roots, and it started as like. Back in like the 30s, right? So it's always had kind of a theatrical life to it, which I like, but I also love that it is taken as a serious sport because it is.
Yeah, when I started 6 years ago, it was all, you know, fishnets, short skirts, boobs out. I don't know how else to say that. But like, yeah, and it was all very theatrical and people wore costumes. And it's definitely been moving towards a more athletic sport, right? Like, it was aired on ESPN3, the championships were, and teams are moving towards not having their derby names on the back of their jerseys and having their last names so that it can be televised. You know, they're wearing sport pants and uniforms and... Yeah, like it's really moving towards more of a professional athletic sport. It's still interesting, like seeing Scald Eagle, like when she's getting ready for a game and she still puts her face paint on. So I think that there's still an element of individuality to whatever, like whatever game you're playing to kind of just commemorate your own identity in roller derby. But yeah, it is definitely moving towards a more athletic notion. Yeah.
And you know, I couldn't play an athletic Olympic sport. Like, part of what was great about roller derby was like, me? You want me to be on your team? You know, like, I'm playing with figures, you know, former figure skaters, former softball stars. Basically, like, it is when gymnastics, when you have aged out of your sport, roller derby is there for you and will carry you into your 60s if you'd like. You can keep skating at any age. And yeah, and when mostly all you do is make jokes for a living. So I'm really grateful for that and the do-it-yourself spirit of it. So I don't know, and it is a bit controversial. Like, it is serious, even if we're being silly. I think you take us seriously because it's serious fun, and it's a difficult sport to play at any level. So maybe there's leagues that are more professional leagues if their sponsorships ever do get involved, which is difficult to do when you're a do-it-yourself team. Like, how do you have sponsorships? I mean, do we really want to be like the Nestle roller girls? You know what I mean? I can see it becomes complicated because we have to have other lives. So you can't necessarily be owned by a company when you're also a kindergarten teacher. You know, and it's hard. So I really understand. What do you do when you want to do this for the rest of your life, but you don't want it to be your career? So maybe we find new avenues, and it's not just rec leagues and pickup bouts and scrimmages, but we actually are able to, I don't know, have sponsorship within wherever there would be a racquetball court and a tennis court and a basketball court. There's also a flat track area where people can skate.
I think for me, it's go ahead. I think for me it's interesting. I just moved to Denver, and Denver Roller Derby is very much one of these very professional leagues with names on back of jerseys rather than, you know, goofy derby names. The league I transferred from was very much a goofy punk rock, very queer league. I got my first team tattoo before I'd been skating with them for a month. It was that kind of just super, like, just gung-ho, wild, really punky league. And I love that there's both of that in derby. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think I'll be sad if one ever totally takes over the other.
I agree. I don't think it will. I think we have so many farm leagues. Like, we have so many leagues in smaller towns that are not going to go to champs, right? And the whole point of why they're doing it is because, like, they're having a lot of fun with it, and they're having those relationships with those women. So, yeah, I don't think it'll ever go away, but I would be sad too at the time.
Yeah. Another thing about derby is that it can get wild and funny and crazy. So there are some things that I'm just going to say because derby is just an amazing thing, and you can really, really make a lot of friends with it. And, like, I was just crushed when the barn burned down, and so I'm currently just trying to help raise it back up.
So I'm going to open it up to you guys for questions now. Does anybody have one?
I didn't want to have to do this, but I have issues of SLAM here, and if you ask a question, you can have one. Oh, there we go.
Bribery. That's the trick.
The weirdest question? Is that what she asked?
Yeah. Weirdest question.
Probably, what is roller derby? Because I was just like, how do you not know what derby is? It's the most amazing thing in the whole world. How do you not know what it is?
You know, you still get asked if it's fake.
Yeah.
That is crazy to
and
me that it's
and
still...
And then I gave a 30... And then I gave like a 10-minute lengthy explanation of what it was, and they were just like, okay, what is derby? And I just walked away because I did not want to scream again at this human.
There you go.
I get a lot of weird looks from my chiropractor. I was doing an intake, and he was like, do you exercise? I was like, yeah, I play roller derby. He's like, you're going to make me so much money.
You do hear from doctors like, I have three other derby girls. They also broke their nose. Like, they're all like, we'll just keep fixing you up.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we're talking about IT bands.
Yes.
Yeah. So, my name's Rebecca. I'm with the R. Kelly High Rollers down in Salina.
Oh, no. Do you know Beth?
Huh?
Sorry.
So, as skaters, I know personally me, I've faced a lot of, you know, hardships in skating and derby, on and off the track. Do you incorporate any of that with your characters in your comics, you know, with them facing hardships and how they got past it and uniting as a team? Do you guys incorporate any of that into your comics?
Yeah, in fact, the second arc of Slam, The Next Jam, is about what happens when you're injured and what it's like to be sidelined when you're kind of watching everybody take off. And one of the girls, it's unfolding pretty slowly, but it's pretty clear that she suffered some trauma in a past relationship she doesn't really want to talk about here. But, it, you know, as tough as she can be on the track, she's still holding her keys, walking to her car like a weapon and running as fast as she can. Because I think derby really brings out the hardest stuff you haven't dealt with, because you're working as hard as you can. And it gets to the very piece of you that needs someone to say, you're awesome, man, and you belong here, and you deserve to be here. So that Slam is all about those moments when you look at someone and say, like, I don't know if I can do it, and someone goes, you absolutely can do it.
Yeah, I think people face a lot of problems in life that run parallel with derby, right? Like, some of the struggles that the skaters in my comic face is just, you know, like, how do I fit in here, right? Like, how do I fit in this environment? How do I make sure that I'm making friends and that this is the place for me? And I think there's also an element to, like, yeah, can I do this, right? You really have to push yourself when it comes to roller derby. It's really easy to quit at the beginning because it's a lot of hard work.
Yeah,
like your body's not happy with you, and I think that really translates to, you know, a new job or like any new venture of, am I going to stick this out and really accomplish it, or am I going to take the path of least resistance? So.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it was a good question. I myself, not a lot of people know it, but I'm working on a graphic novel of my own, and she is part-time, not superhero, not villain. So, and she's also part-time derby amazing person. So, yeah. She experiences a lot of anger and trauma in the first part of the book. You'll be able to see it if and when it comes out. And so she just kind of tries to express that through derby, and she just imagines that the people from the other team, and this idea also came from Roller Girl, are the villain that she's currently trying to kill, or at least extremely harm somehow. I don't know how, but I'm only on page 8. Don't judge me.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, it's nice they want to try a girl thing. I mean, it looked fun, right? So they had to get on board. I do have what it's like to have someone in your life decide to become an NSO so that they aren't a derby widow, but perhaps. Yeah. I mean, it's tough. And they're also, you know, the track monkeys and everybody who... You can't skate roller derby without everybody that puts on the bout. And sometimes that's the... It's also the man who's cooking food at home for your kids because you're out at practice for 3 or 4 hours. So I try to talk about men's roles in that. I didn't really necessarily want to talk about a men's league because that guy can go make that comic about his league. Yeah. But I'm aware that, you know, this sport is only successful as the people who can support the skaters.
Definitely.
And then sometimes your MVP is the person who's at home.
I haven't yet. All of the main characters in my comic book are women or girls, and I kind of did that specifically just because we don't really have a lot of comics where we get to be front and center and, you know, not the sidekick or the damsel in distress.
And so I specifically chose female characters as the main focal point. I probably will incorporate like a ref or a coach at some point, but yeah, that's just specifically why I chose, you know, female specific.
Yeah, mine didn't start until like issue 8 or 5, and I was like, okay, fine. Yeah. Like,
we should probably.
Yeah. No, I didn't, just one time at practice, we all had to stop skating, and then I heard someone say, "We found some of her tooth, but not all of her tooth."
Oh,
my God. And I hear it in my head sometimes in moments. That'll really make you stop.
That's awful.
She should have worn her mouth guard.
Yeah, she should have worn her
mouth guard. Don't try to be pretty.
Yeah. Don't. Just don't. It's for your own sake. And worst injury I've seen is broken arm. And I don't want to say this, but best injury, probably like either a bruise or a sprained wrist. I don't know what you would consider better, because I get a bruise like once a week because the track is rock hard. Yeah. It's that old. But now it's going to be new because the park burned down.
You're going to get the track, yes.
Yeah. Because right? The track melted.
Yeah, no, I know, but you said you guys are doing a fundraiser, right? So you're going to get a new track?
Yeah, the fundraiser ended at 5-ish.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
all right.
So, yeah.
I say the most common injury is knee injuries. Like, it's all knee injuries. You meet people who used to play derby, and they're like, yeah, I got a cadaver knee. It's awesome now. I can, like, walk up the stairs.
I have a torn PCL.
Yep. Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yep.
Forever.
And the worst injury I've seen, we once played a league that was, they practiced maybe once a month, and the girl broke her femur on the track. We still play for like 40 minutes, like while the ambulance came, and we had to turn up the music because she was crying so hard. Like that was a really rough night. So don't, you have to practice more than once a month. That's the lesson.
Okay. We used to practice every Saturday.
What?
We used to practice every Saturday, so I've kind of already broken your rule.
Yeah.
Don't worry, you'll get back to it.
You'll get that track soon.
Yeah.
To reiterate, the most, like, as somebody that's been watching for a couple years and as a coach, absolutely the most common injury I see is knee injuries. Yeah. Like, people twisting their knee and, like, tweaking their knee in a weird way. And it's just because you're on rolling wheels on your feet.
Like, well, and also, I mean,
your hips get tight. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just tell people that are young, like, credit cards are not money, and be nice to your knees. That's it. Like, you can get so far in life.
But it's fun. You should skate.
You really bounce back.
Yeah, my coaches like to yell, "Derby's dance!" And basically, they're just saying, pop a squat.
Yeah,
That's all Derby's dance is. Just, like, pop a permanent squat and just keep rolling.
Scissors has a question.
Yeah, they have made a bid a couple of times to put Derby in the Olympics. There's a whole process to do it, and I know it's gone through like the formal thing at least twice, and I think they only allow so many new sports per year. I'm not sure why it can't happen yet.
It would be so amazing if they did, though. I would just be like,
you know why?
All my worries out the window.
Because then you can get a scholarship to the college you want, because you're going to play roller derby for that college and university.
Just like, please, why can't it be a sport for the Olympics? Yeah. It is a sport. Why isn't it qualified as one?
I think you found your calling. Yeah. I think you're going to be the one who gets
advocate.
It in.
Yeah.
I think if we have shuffleboard, we can have roller derby.
Yes, if we have curling.
Yeah, we can,
Curling is more intense than you think, I think.
I'm not talking about intensity.
Don't try to justify that curling and roller derby on the same level.
Saying if you can bring a broom to the sport.
I think there's an interesting discussion about getting roller derby in the Olympics, though, because right now, women's flat track roller derby, which is kind of the one that would most likely go to the Olympics, is a little more progressive in its politics than the Olympics is.
Definitely.
You know, roller derby is an incredibly queer-affirming sport. Like Kat mm-hmm. said, it's not one where kind of queerness is swept under the rug, but it is one where all bodies and all people are really celebrated and uplifted. And without getting into, like, all the specifics, the Olympics doesn't really have that culture and doesn't really have the rules to support that. In fact, it has rules that would kind of actively sweep people under the rug.
Yes, or disqualify skaters, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah.
So I think, personally, I can't wait to see roller derby in the Olympics, and I think that part of that is the Olympics changing as well, so all those sports kind of mm-hmm. get on our level, because roller right. derby's like, we're really setting the standard.
Rock has a question now.
Rock had to beat scissors. My huh? favorite roller derby one.
Moments.
Oh, memories.
I think for me, it was when I got my concussion. That wasn't tremendously fun. But as soon as I got home, a bunch of people started sending me text messages. I had to have my wife read them to me, because you're not supposed to look at your phone while you have a concussion. It's bad for your brain. And I didn't know what was going on, but my wife texted my team our home address. And a couple days later, I got roller derby coloring books. And I got Aww. Jars of pickles, because they're one of my favorite foods. It was just this really beautiful moment for me, because my team really means everything to me. And roller derby, for me, is always about the community that you're in. There's skating is fun, hitting people is fun, even getting knocked over is fun.
Yeah.
But the community Definitely. That you're part of is just magical. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's friends for lifetime. When you have someone on a team, and your team was the world. When you got together and everybody's looking at you like, oh, they're going to be murdered. And then you win. You come from behind and win because the other team was like, I guess we don't have to work so hard. And then you stayed late every night working on the same drills with your coach yelling at you. And then you win and the mean coach is crying because she's actually just really proud of you. Those things last forever. And I have friends for life because of roller derby. I have 100 wonderful friends, but I have like, well, I have 100 wonderful friends for life. I'm not even going to rank them. Like, yeah. You just come with a lifelong support and a team that's always got your back.
Yeah, for me, I would definitely say, like, even the hardships that I've experienced in the barn, I got a massive bruise on my leg, and I was just ow the entire ride home because it hurt to sit down. So... yeah, I'm actually surprised that I made it through the last few weeks of school. Because it was hard. It was hard to sit down and walk. So it was basically hard to do everything, except sleep. Sleeping was nice.
I think my favorite memories are always just traveling with my team. So, you know, you all get together and you leave at 4 o'clock in the morning from the airport because you all have to buy the cheap tickets because everyone's like saving every penny to go, and like you're all crammed in a hotel room or like an Airbnb, and it smells so bad because like your pads are everywhere and they're like drying from being sweaty. You know what I mean? It's just like you're spending 3 days together, all of you, and you don't really get any time to yourself, but it's super fun, and you always come back from those just almost like floating from how great of an experience it was. So yeah, I always really like traveling with my team.
So if I could actually inject my favorite roller derby memories, I have two daughters that skate for the junior team. One of them just turned 16 and one of them just turned 7. So she just got to start derby. Watching my 16-year-old use something that I taught her to lay someone flat legally on the track like my favorite moment. I was like, yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, I've seen her lay plenty of people flat illegally, but legally was great. Like, sweet, that is not a back block. That is just a massive hit. And then today my wife sent me a video. My 7-year-old is going for her level 1, which is like the first level to be able to skate on the track. And so they have to do 8 laps in 2 minutes, and she made it to 6. So, and it's awesome. She's been skating for like 2 months, and it's just so amazing to watch, like, literally a person this tall, like, hit somebody this tall and, like, skate around a track. as fast as humanly possible for a 7-year-old. Yeah. So those are my favorite derby memories.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's nice.
And for level 2, you have to do 15 laps in 3 minutes. And then to get into the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, you have to do 27
in
5.
So there was a massive influx of people that I think maybe for the next panel, I just want to let you guys know we're talking about roller derby. So if you have any questions like that. Oh, sorry.
Hitting people. I just love hip checking people and just roller skating around a track as fast as an amateur 12-year-old with derby can, and just hip checking people as hard as I can, and just imagining that they are my worst enemy, who I'm not going to name because they might be in this room and I don't want to offend them. Bye.
Having a second life is kind of exciting. That has nothing to do with any bad day you might have had, or what's expected of you, or who you're supposed to be, or how many kids, you know, you knock a girl down and then find out she's a mother of 4. Like, you're a little like, sorry. You know, she doesn't want you, there's no sorry in roller derby, right? You don't say it, because we're all supposed to play to the top of each other's skills. And if you apologize to someone, it means you think they weren't as good. They didn't deserve the hit that you gave them. So you play. Don't be a dick is actually rule number 1. But rule number 2 is no saying I'm sorry. And those 2 things will get you so far in life, by the way, that that's another reason to keep going. And to have that reaffirmed over and over again, that someone is just skating with their with all the respect they have for you, and you're skating with all the respect right back. It all does end up being therapeutic, but it also just makes you remember that, like, people are good. And there's something about roller derby that really brings out the best, like, pickles sent to a house, man. Like, that's the best, right? That's pure roller derby right there. Like, she needs pickles.
Yeah.
How do we do it?
There's nothing like being in the thick of a game. Like, there's nothing like it. And whenever you're watching from the sidelines or you're repping and you see somebody lay some, like, dope hit or jump the apex, you just think, I wish I had my skates on right now. I also think that inclusivity of roller derby is what keeps people coming back, right? It's a really safe place for a lot of people when they don't have one. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to a lot of people. And I also think that because roller derby is so grassroots, we have to, like, we all volunteer our time, right? We all have to make the league going. No one is getting paid to just make sure that your league runs smoothly. And so it constantly feels like you are building something, right? You're, like, building something better, and you're building it for your community. And I think that gives a lot of people purpose with roller derby.
I think for me, the one thing about roller derby that has affected me the most was when I was doing my first 27 and 5 test. I got to about 22 laps, and I looked at my coach, who was counting my laps for me, and I shook my head because I didn't think I had it. And she shook her head and jumped up and skated in front of me and said, no, no, I didn't show up here for you to not give it your all. You got this. Skate. And I thought, like, you're crazy. Like, I can't do this. And then I did it. And then the next time I did that test, I thought, I can't do this. And then I did it. And what roller derby taught me was every time my brain lies to me and says, I can't do this, I can do it. And roller derby making you tough and making you brave and making you self-assured is something that I hope I never forget.
Yeah, and for a culture that can really be a butt-shaming culture, boy, do you love your butt.
Yeah.
Like, you are so proud of your butt. Like, you just want people to look at it all the time. You worked so hard on it, and it's very powerful now. It's like a weapon.
Yeah.
And, you know, your butt always has your back. Like, it's amazing what happens when you've changed your body this way.
I'm definitely going to teach my skaters the weaponized butt theory.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing.
Like, no airport is difficult to get through anymore.
Yeah.
And all you do after you skate is, like, look at other people's butts.
Yes, yes.
Like, whether they play roller derby or not.
Yes, it's, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't ever wear a decent pair of jeans. They just don't fit anymore.
You got to get stretchy again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things about derby is you just make, as we've said earlier, multiple times, you make so many lifelong friends, and I just miss him so much because I haven't seen him in a few weeks, and I'm just like, man, the barn's burnt down. So, yeah. And I just remembered another crazy question that I heard. So I said, oh, yeah, I play Derby. And then someone said, oh, you play Derby? What's your horse's name? And I was just like, get out now. And then I explained to them in a very calm manner what Derby was again. Yes. I hate explaining what Derby is because it's so complicated.
So we're wrapping up. We have just a couple minutes left. For the creators that have a booth, can you tell people where you can find them? And for the two that I don't think have booths, remind us again who you skate for and maybe like when your next bout or your next fundraiser is going to be.
Yeah, cool. So I have a booth in Artist Valley. It's N as in November 13, and it's just like black, white, and pink, and you can't miss it.
I'm not at my booth anymore because I'm sold out. So I brought everything that was left for you guys to just take for coming to this Derby panel. So please come and get things. And then I also, I have a book out called My Boyfriend is a Bear. It's for older people. they have some language involved, but it's about a girl who dates a 400-pound American black bear. He's wonderful, and he's perfect for her. He's a really good cuddler. But he has to go hibernate, so they don't know if they can survive long distance. That's it.
And another thing, I've read the first four slam books of the first arc, and it is amazing. The art will just blow you away. It's so funny, and like they hardly ever say sorry. So, and when they do, the response is, "Really? There's no sorry in roller derby." But yeah,
thank you.
It's great. I love roller derby. It is fun.
So I just transferred to Denver Roller Derby, but I have actually my first ever bout is coming up. I'm going back to North Carolina to skate with my old league. So that's super exciting. I don't have any fundraisers for any of the teams that I'm involved with, but please, please support Boulder. You know, that fire was really awful. It was devastating.
Where can we contribute to the fundraiser?
Boulder County Bombers has a Facebook page. There's a photo of our infamous duct tape ball, and it is a duct tape ball. It's like 12 inches in diameter. It's huge, and now it's just like 6 inches in diameter. It's kind of depressing.
There's also a fundraiser coming up on Wednesday, I think, that involves alcohol. So if you're the kind of person who enjoys alcohol, I encourage you to do so while also supporting a sport that really creates a fantastic community, not just for adults, not just for queers, but also for kids. You know, if you read any of the comic books that talk about roller derby, you'll understand just how important it is for the people who play it, kind of what it can do for you and how it can build you up. And, you know, think of the kids. Go buy a beer and support roller derby.
And Kat, how can people find you?
I am at table U22 in Artist Alley selling Lumberjanes things.
Awesome. Let's
give there are Lumberjanes badges, sorry. And the one with the roller skate is from the Derby arc, and the Derby arc is absolutely hysterical. I'm just going to say it.
Thank you.
Let's give our panel a round of applause.
So we're on the floor of Denver Comic Con again, thinking outside the long box. Don't know why I said that, because you've probably been listening to this episode for 2 hours already. But I am sitting here with one of my personal heroes. This is Terry Moore. He is the creator of Strangers in Paradise, Motor Girl, Rachel Rising. Terry, how are you doing today, man?
Well, I'm a little dingy because it's Sunday. But, man, what a great weekend, and so I'm in a good mood. We've had a great show.
Awesome. So my first question for you is, you have created in Strangers in Paradise this world that is inhabited by very real emotional people and assassins and yakuza and like killers and crazy violence. Where did you draw the inspiration to say, I want to make this almost polyamorous relationship story blend with this incredible violence? Like, where did you take that inspiration?
Well, I feel like as a kid, when I was growing up, that my favorite entertainment seemed to have a lot of romance and hope and brightness to it. I'm thinking about the comedies and of the 60s and 70s, and a lot of them were about relationships and free love and all this kind of stuff. So balance that with now I live in today's world, and today's world is not that way at all. So, yeah, if you take somebody who grew up as a romantic and who was worshipped women, and then you put them in today's world that it's really violent and dangerous and you need to be on your toes, you kind of get my books.
When you're, like, looking at creating, like, these characters, how is it that, I mean, it's kind of hard for me to explain because, like, when I'm reading them, they are real people. Like, they come across as very real people. There are very few, like, comic writers that manage to evoke that sense of real people having real interactions. How do you approach your writing and how do you approach your art to evoke, like, those real emotions in people?
You know, it's weird. I think I'm just wired to write a certain way because when I look at my sketchbook from when I was 10 years old, and it has drawings of superheroes in it, but it also has, like, my first cartoon sequence, which is a guy and a girl having a relationship discussion. Who does that at the age of 10?
That does seem really kind of odd. At 10, I think I was still just, like, riding my bike around a lot.
I lived on my bike, and then I drew Spider-Man and wondered how to draw muscles. But I also drew, you know, these... I was always drawing boyfriend, girlfriend, talking heads, talking it out. And because there were jokes there for me to work with. And then, of course, when I got into school and started having girlfriends, I made every mistake. So then you start making jokes about that. And I guess I'm wired the same way that a comedian might be wired. You know, it's not that I understand these things. It's that I won't let them go. And I keep exploring my failures and why are guys losing every single argument with their girlfriend? Things like that, you know.
One of my favorite things is the boyfriend that has kept the pictures, the bikini pictures, for years and years and years, and how it, like, backfires on him over and over and over again in the series.
And he won't let him go.
Like, because, you know, so... Weird personal story. Like, I was at like an outdoor event in my hometown, literally like last Friday. I saw my first girlfriend. Like, you know, she was there with her kids and whatever, doing her own thing.
Oh, like Splendor in the Grass.
And there was this moment where I was like, should I talk to her? And I, like, felt teenage nervousness. I was like, I haven't seen her in like 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Should I say anything? And we both kind of made eye contact, and I know we both recognized each other. And in that moment, we were both so embarrassed that we didn't know what to say that we just didn't say anything. Like,
oh, yeah.
And I feel like your books evoke that a lot of the time, this sense of like, holy crap, what do I do? I'm going to do nothing. Like, I'm going to do nothing.
Think about it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So, moving on to Rachel Rising, this is a horror book. Like, it's creepy, but it still has, like, your same, like, sensibility of, like, relationship and, like, the art style that is so, like, evocative of, like, you know, evocative of emotion. Like, how do you approach something so different? Like, or, like, with Motor Girl, like, I mean, it's got a monkey character. Like, how do you go from...
It's not a monkey, it's a gorilla.
My bad, sorry. A great ape. Yes. Like, how do you go from like genre to genre so comfortably?
I don't know. When I was writing Strangers in Paradise, I was the guy known for relationships and writing women. And then I would do panels and people would say, how do you write women so well? And I kind of just got to the point where I finally just said, I don't really understand, but I feel like a writer. I mean, I feel like I could write a serial killer just as well. And people would laugh, and then after I start doing Rachel Rising, they stop laughing. Because Rachel Rising has a serial killer in it, and I don't know. Actually, The first real prose short story I ever wrote was a horror story. When I was 13. And I don't know, I liked all the old horror movies, the black and whites, and most of the Hammer films. So I always had that in my head. And one of the things when I finished Strangers in Paradise, people were telling me, you moved me emotionally in a romantic way when I read it. And then once I felt like, okay, I've managed to make a comic book, a 2D on paper thing that reads, that gives that, and the reader gets that emotion, that's pretty cool. I wonder if I can give somebody reading a comic book the creeps.
Yeah.
Can I get that emotion too out of a reader? And it's, when you think about it, it's just a piece of paper with a drawing on it. It's hard to imagine that you could actually affect somebody emotionally, but if you can suck them into the story and then take a right turn, you know, that's the fun of creating.
So when you're like trying to I'm actually going to retract that question. Cut that moment. Sorry. Mark, cut.
Mark, cut, delete. God damn it. No.
Now I can't cut it.
So in Strangers in Paradise, there's a lot of song lyrics and a lot of like poetry. And I've never done my due diligence to look up like the names of the music, you know, of the songs and of the writers. Are those songs from other people or are those things that you've written?
In the original printings, it's half and half. And then when I started making the pocketbooks and getting into bookstores, I replaced all the pocketbooks, I replaced all the other people's music with my own. And I was originally a musician, and I wrote a lot of songs, and I kept those notes in those notebooks. And when it was time for Strangers in Paradise, I just threw everything I could make into it. Poetry, songs, music. I just made it my one creative vehicle. You know, a lot of people will have a creative idea for this and one for that. I just put it all into one title.
And it seems like you're very comfortable going from scripting to poetry to prose, because there's really lengthy pieces of prose, the quote-unquote Strangers in Paradise novel that Kachu is reading, you know?
Yeah.
And with that comfort level, I mean, would you ever feel like I could write a whole novel or I could write this? Like, is that something that you would ever feel comfortable reading, or do you just, you like being able to put all of your things into that one basket?
I'm actually, for the old time Strangers in Paradise fans, I'm famous for not writing the novel, because I always said, I think I'll write a follow-up story, but it'll be a novel format. And so people were always waiting for a novel that never came. And what I've discovered is I can't write a novel and be on a comic book deadline at the same time.
Okay.
Because the drawing takes forever. So I wish that I was disciplined enough to work on the novel for 2 hours every morning at 5 a.m., but I'm not.
Yeah, I always set myself that goal when it comes to my writing, and I always don't do it.
No, it's not going to happen.
Or like workout schedule, too. I'll wake up at 5 and go to the gym.
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
No, I don't think so.
Not today. Maybe tomorrow.
There's just too many times where I'm getting to bed at 4, so that
right.
The 5 really sucks.
So you have new issues of Strangers in Paradise coming out. I have purchased them, and they are in my pool box, but I have not had a chance to read them. Where are the characters going from here?
They all join a nunnery and sit in a circle, and nothing happens.
I would still read that? The crap out of that. So,
for 20 pages.
I would. I absolutely would read that if they just sat there. I'd be like, this is so great. What is he trying to tell me?
And tell each other their faults, you know. Like Festivus.
Never mind. I'm not going to. There's a cult that I read about, but I can't remember. The Process Church. They would sit in like circles and literally criticize each other until you were willing to accept all of your criticism. So,
okay, well, what if you accept it in the first 1 minute and you're done?
Yeah. Hey, guys, I'm out.
Yeah. You win. Okay, well, the basic setup for the new series is that it's 5 years after the big series ended. And they have a beautiful friends. Kachu has a beautiful family. And I'm not trying not to give her any spoilers.
Yeah.
And so she's happy. But, she, you know, she has a bad past. And somebody from the past has been hauled in front of a Senate committee. And has threatened to made an immunity deal for to tell the Senate everything about the Parker girls, which Kachu belonged to. And she doesn't want if this information gets out, her life is ruined. So she goes to try to find that person to stop them from telling. And that person runs and it becomes kind of a chase story.
Oh, cool. I'm excited. I'm very excited to read it, but it's like it's one of those things. I have so many stacks of comics at home that I'm like, they end up being in alphabetical order.
Well, you just need to kick.
S,
no,
it's like three, four.
No, just
down.
Kick them over. Find the S one and pull it out.
I'm really close. Like right now, I'm really close. I have them in my bag, though. So
let me reorder those for you.
Yeah. Would you like to order 8 extra copies for me?
Yeah.
You did a commission for me this weekend. You drew Conan the Barbarian for me.
Oh, yes, I did.
I am super, super grateful for. When you get commissions like mine that are oddball, how do you approach that? Because I've always wondered.
I'm kind of, if it's something I really don't want to draw, you know, I'll say no. But if it's something I've never drawn, like Conan, I think, yeah, I would like to do that because, you know, I don't want to get into a rut. And so I'm happy to look at new things. And when I have to draw Conan, even though I've read Conan growing up and, you know, everything, still, when I have to draw him, I have to go back and really look at him for a minute and be in his shoes. And it's nice escape to do it.
That's cool. I'm going to be super positive about it. It's such an amazing sketch. And when I showed it to my wife, like, I've been talking to her a lot about the character because I'm working on doing a YouTube thing about it. And I talked about how he's always talked about as, you know, full of great melancholy and great mirth. And the way you drew him, he's got a little bit of a grin. But my wife said he captured the sadness in his eyes. And I was like, man, this is the best. So I'm so excited.
You know,
so.
When I was drawing it, you have to choose what's your moment. And usually when you see a Conan drawing, it's his moment of power. And I thought, I always like to draw before or after the moment. And I took the moment afterwards where the whatever he just pillaged is on fire behind him. And he's tired. It's been a long day of fighting. And you get that look where you're looking up at him and he's looking down at you. And he's already made up his mind whether he's going to kill you or not. And one or the other is about to happen. And I can't tell if he's tired of the killing or if he's going to let us go.
That's awesome. I love it. I'm so proud to have it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Because there's a con, I have to keep these interviews pretty short. Tell our listeners, how can they find you online and how can they get a hold of your books?
I hope I'm easy to find. I am Terry Moore Art on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And we have a website that's easy to find. Just, you know, Google me and you'll get the website. And there's a store there where you can buy anything.
Very cool. Well, Terry, thank you so much for your time. Like, you're absolutely one of my favorite independent comic book artists. Like, I love your work.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. Doing another interview right now. We're sitting here with Gene Ha, who has worked on, I mean, just an insane amount of DC projects and also worked on Top 10 with Alan Moore. And his current comic, May, is out with Lion Forge. Gene, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. It's just a whirlwind of excitement and activity at Denver Comic Con. So it's been fun. It's been busy. It's been tiring and energizing. And obviously, I have had too much caffeine.
I think that's really the only way to make it through one of these weekends is just to pound coffee till your head hurts. And then drink water until your headache goes away.
Yeah, I pity people who can't handle caffeine. I don't know how people live without it.
So my first question has to do with the myriad of DC projects that you've worked on.
Yeah.
Which of those did you find as an artist the most challenging?
Oh, challenge. Man, there's so many weird little challenges along the way. if you give me a specific type of challenging, like so there are things that are hard to draw or storytelling that's hard to draw or just hard to figure out, there's a thing, but I kind of go through the same process with every project. And if you ask me about a specific one, I can tell you the process I use where I break down the story and figure out what the writer is trying to get across. And I've gotten better at it over time. When I first started off, I actually thought I was knew exactly what they wanted, and then I screwed up badly. but you figure that out, and that tells you how you should draw the story, what's important in it. A lot of, like for instance, a lot of artists just hate doing backgrounds. They'll figure out any excuse for not drawing the background. And an important part for me is to figure out, is the setting an important part of the story, and how much of it do I have to draw? And then I come to that horrible realization, like on Top 10, all of it.
All of it.
Yeah, Top 10 was obviously very challenging.
So when you're looking at approaching a project like Batman, say where Gotham is like an important part of the story, as opposed to Superman, where it, like Metropolis just kind of seems like city, American city. Is that kind of what you're talking about? How you approach?
Oh yeah. Superman is about sunshine, glass surfaces, everything beautiful and hopeful, and kind of just building to this future, this unimaginably beautiful future. Batman, are you much of a film buff?
Yeah.
Okay, Batman is almost a Western. But you know how the Western's about horizontal space going across your CinemaScope screen? Batman's the same thing sideways.
Okay,
it's about space, it's about verticality, and about this uncontrollable Wild West that goes from top to bottom.
That's awesome. That's a really interesting way to think about like it, like as somebody that's not an artist, like that's a really fascinating way to think about it in that like cinematography, but going in the opposite aspect, basically.
Oh, yeah. There's an aspect of Westerns where it's like out here, there are no rules, and therefore anyone with a gun is kind of equal to anyone else with a gun. You know, the whole equalizer thing. In Batman, that's not true at all. One guy with a gun is useless. One guy with a big hammer who's insane enough is suddenly the most dangerous criminal in the world. And Batman is somebody who's trying to be... It's that whole verticality of Gotham City where it's like you're trying to get to the top of the heat either to oppress everyone else or loot everyone else or impose order on everyone else. And it's just this constant fight for rank.
So yesterday when I was doing the panel on cultural consciousness in comic books, you were doing this amazing thing where you were taking pictures with your iPad of people in the crowd.
Yeah.
And then you would zoom in on them and you would sketch them. Is that something that you like to do a lot of the time?
Yes. I think that's about 2 years ago I started doing this, and I was just on a panel. And frankly, everyone else on the panel is saying so many interesting things. I was like, what am I going to do while they're all saying all these interesting things that I have nothing to add to? So I started drawing some people in the audience, and it just became a thing for me. Unless I'm the only person on the panel, at which point it just becomes I'd be a jerk if I was just drawing the whole time instead of talking.
So I'm not going to lie. I was a tiny bit jealous. I was like, oh, look at all those awesome people getting that. But I thought it was really interesting to see how quickly you could sketch in pencil and then use the pen, the ink pen to like just make it pop.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to kind of develop that skill to make like an accurate portrait?
2 years of art school. What I do is, I entered art school at the age of 18, and I wasn't old enough to drink until I turned 21. And so me and my friends would go to a bar, and I'd start drawing people. And if they liked the drawing, I'd say, if you like the drawing, you can buy me a beer. And if you really like it, you can buy beers for the whole table. And it really helped if you did couples where the guy's trying to impress his girlfriend.
Right.
And if I got too drunk, then I couldn't get a likeness anymore, and I had to stop for a while. And also if I couldn't get the likeness in the first place, then I couldn't get any drinks. So therefore, I learned to get likenesses really well and really quickly.
So going to art school, like, did you feel going into your career that art school prepared you to work in the field that you're working in?
To some extent. At that time, it was still really disreputable to say that you wanted to become a comic book artist at an art school. And nowadays, I mean, there are some professors and instructors who are really against it. But, I mean, there are major programs at all these great art schools across the country. And, you know, the New York Review, New York Times is reviewing comic books and stuff like that on a pretty regular basis. It's, you know, it can be respectable. So it taught me how to draw. It taught me anatomy, improved my perspective skills, but they didn't really teach comic books, which is so much more about storytelling from panel to panel than it is about anything else. And if you could master that skill, you know, I mean, I can draw a much better pectoral muscles and deltoids and all that type of stuff than Raina Telgemeier. But I'm not going to claim that I'm anywhere close to as good of a storyteller as she is.
That's awesome. So you worked on Top 10 Comics with Xander Cannon and Alan Moore.
Yeah.
They're two of my favorite comic book writers. I love Kaiju Max. It's hilarious to me that Xander does. And obviously, if you don't say you like Alan Moore, comic book fans get upset with you. So
yeah.
What was it like working with those guys on Top 10?
I really lucked out when I asked Xander to work on the book. And I didn't know what he was going to do in the book. I just knew I was not going to be able to keep up with the deadlines and draw that much city behind it, everything. So we started off with him doing pencils and me trying to do finishes, me doing pencils and him doing finishes. And we pretty quickly figured out I'm better doing finishes. He's better doing the layouts. And the thing is, Xander has much broader comic experience than me. Not more time, but just he did self-published comics where he had to do the publishing, the lettering, the inking, the writing. He knew every step of the process and could analyze it in ways I couldn't at the time. And he still can't. I mean, frankly, he's just a genius. So when we got the Alan Moore scripts, I'd start interpreting it. And then I'd hand it to Xander and he'd say, okay, here's what I think is going on here. And he'd point out all these things I did not see. So it was the most amazing education you could really ask for in comics, where I had scripts written just for me by the most legendary writer in the history of comics. And then analyzed by a genius who had all the qualifications he needed to understand what Alan Moore was doing.
That's awesome. So tell us about May.
May is it's a project where I'm finally doing the Xander. So I'm not doing the lettering, but I am writing it. I'm drawing it. For the first two issues, I did all the coloring, and now I'm doing tweaks on the coloring to make it match the style. And It's my dream project, something I've been wanting to do for a while. And it's the story of two sisters from rural Indiana. And one sister comes back after being missing for all of her teen years from 13 to the age of 21 and just claims she's been on another world, which is really hard to believe until some of the monsters from that world start following her back to Indiana. And this is how the nerdy, dorky, geeky younger sister, May, gets dragged into the action hero adventures of her older sister. But May is not an action hero. Abby can be punched by an ogre, thrown 30 feet against a brick wall, and then just bounce up and say, oh, you just made me angry. If that happened to May, she'd just die, just like the rest of us.
Awesome.
She has to be smart.
So wrapping up, how can people find May and find you on the internet so that they can enjoy a book where the stakes are somebody could die if they get hit by an ogre?
Okay, so double check the title of this podcast. You'll find the spelling of my name there, Gene Ha, and add a .com at the end. That's all you'll find my website. I'm being published through Lion Forge. So Lion like Lion, the King of the Jungle, and Forge like forging Thor's hammer.
That's awesome. So thank you so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it. Like, you are a phenomenal artist, and it was a pleasure to watch you work on stage for a couple.
Oh.
So thank you very much.
Oh, before we go, one last secret.
Yes.
If you want to get a sketch of yourself at a panel where I'm at, go to one where there are multiple people on the panel with me and sit in the front, first or second row, so I can actually see you. Because if you're way in the back, you're going to be out of focus and I can't take an iPad photo of you.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Dean. I appreciate it. Very well. So back on the show, we have with us author Liv Hayden. How are you today, Liv?
Good. How are you?
I am doing really good. So your book, In the Mind of Revenge, is already out.
Yes.
And then you have another book that is called Counting Bodies Like Stars.
Yes.
Which is going to be a science fiction book, from what I understand.
Yeah, it's sci-fi adventure.
Awesome. So you seem like a really multifaceted creator. Tell us about all of the various projects that you work on.
Yeah, I would say besides my writing, my most recent endeavor, I actually started my own podcast.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So that's probably my most recent creative endeavor. Professionally, I did web design and graphic design for a really long time, mostly for businesses, small business branding and things like that. And that's been fun. And then now the business that I run on the side of writing, I do editing for other authors, formatting, cover design, that whole part of the creative process that a lot of people can feel very overwhelmed by.
Right.
Yeah.
I wrote
for a National Novel Writing Month one year, I wrote a book and
awesome.
Like actually finished it and like sent it out. And the whole process was like, wow. So the writing part's the easy part. The rest of this shit is completely confounding. So.
Yeah. If you can get through your first draft, I think that's the first big hurdle. And then after that, it's like, what do I do with this now? Because there's so many different things you can do. And then there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And
yeah,
just
I did
so
it
much.
The wrong way. So, at, like, as a writer, when you're approaching, like, that entire process, like, from beginning to end, you know, you talk about the first draft as being the big, you know, first hurdle.
Right.
Like, is it a super satisfying feeling for you when you get finished with a book? Or do you kind of think to yourself, ah, crap, now the real work starts?
Oh, no, I totally get a high off of it, for sure. Let's see. I've effectively finished a manuscript, I want to say, 5 times. I think 3 of those times it was In the Mind of Revenge. That book's been rewritten quite a bit. And then 2 times it was Counting Bodies Like Stars, which is the other book.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, I've gotten... I don't know why this happens, but the closer I get to the end, the less I can sleep. And I have to keep writing. And so I end up on this bender of, like, 7 days of running on, like, 3 hours of sleep because I can't stop writing. And so I think it could be a combination of, like, that high of finishing the novel and also just deliriousness.
I know that when I get really involved with a writing project, it drives my wife absolutely crazy because, like, it's all I want to talk about. It's all I want to work on. And I'll be like, I'm going to the basement. Like, I'm going to go right now. And, well, come on. Like, can we at least hang out for an hour or two? I'm like, no, I got stuff to do.
No, I'll be totally distracted. You won't even really have my attention.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it. It turns into an obsession.
It's awful and amazing all at once.
Yeah, yeah.
So, In the Mind of Revenge is a thriller.
Yeah.
And then Counting Bodies Like Stars, like you said, is a science fiction novel. Why follow up, like, genre to genre? Like, you know... Most writers, they find a genre they're comfortable with, and then they just write in that genre. Like, why jump from genre to genre?
Yeah, well, I would say the genre thing can be a little misleading. It's really just a marketing piece. The genre piece of things has more to do with how publishers and writers position their things based on who they think they can sell to than it does the actual content of the story. The voice and pacing and mystery and thriller elements that are in The Mind of Revenge are still in Counting Bodies Like Stars. There are medical sci-fi elements in The Mind of Revenge. It's just, you know, in the bookstore, they decided to put it on the thriller shelf and not the sci-fi shelf. So I would say really the biggest difference between the two novels has more to do with the setting. So even though there's sci-fi stuff in The Mind of Revenge, it's set on Earth. It's in Baltimore most of the time. It's very near future. There's really not much that world building I had to do because we all know how this world works.
Right.
Whereas in Counting Bodies Like Stars, the whole thing takes place in space in the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a galaxy we've not even touched before. So I'm making all this stuff up. And so I have to do a lot more world building and, you know, create governments and how laws work and how travel works and blah, blah, blah. And all of that is very obviously sci-fi. So that's going to go on a sci-fi shelf.
Right.
I would say for readers who enjoyed the pacing and the action focus of In the Mind of Revenge, you're going to get the same thing in this next novel.
Very cool. So
yeah.
It more has to do with how it gets shelved than anything else.
Yeah. In my case, I do know that there are authors who do genre jump. I just think if you read the two works, you'll recognize my voice in both of them.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned you have a podcast. Please plug it first. What is it and where can people find it?
Yeah, it's called the Self-Aware Millennial Podcast. It's only 8 episodes in, so it's a brand new baby. And so I'm working on that, learning a lot. Obviously, I listen to a lot of other podcasts, you know, podcasts like yours that are super established and get some good ideas for that. It's basically, it's geared toward millennials. And the idea is I ended up through a random assortment of... I've had a freelance career pretty much since I was 20, and so I've done all kinds of random things. You know, if you're going to live that life, you have to be willing to kind of be a Renaissance man of sorts. And so I got exposed to all of these really great corporate self-awareness, emotional intelligence training, and I have all of these skills, and I've read all of these books, and I just kept thinking, God, if people my age had access to this, if they knew it existed, if they could figure out how to figure themselves out before you get to that midlife space where you're like, wait, I don't even know who I am, then we could, you know, effectively do better than our parents did, which is the point, right? The point is always to do better than the generation before you.
That's why I tell my kids.
Right? Yeah.
Please,
I mean,
please, God, do better than me.
My mom totally drilled that in my head. And she's the reason I've been exposed to so much of this stuff, because she's an award-winning executive coach. And so she's got all of these resources and tools that she's been so kind and gracious to share with me for free. I mean, we're talking like tens of thousands of dollars of training I've just done for free. And so I want to gift that back. And so I've been sharing the things I've learned, the resources I've learned. And we talk about everything from, you know, social issues with like labels, intergenerational communication, because that's a big deal in the workplace right now, all the way up to how do you deal with your anxiety and how can self-awareness help you with that, self-care and the importance of that, your body image, all kinds of stuff.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how do you feel like kind of jumping into like the podcasting world has or will affect your writing?
Well, hopefully, I think as a creator, the more different types of mediums you can get into, the more creators you meet, the better you get at any one of your crafts. I definitely think as far as my writing goes, this will help my nonfiction writing probably more than my fiction writing, but I definitely think any writing of any sort helps your writing overall. You get more precise with your language. Some of the stuff that they use in nonfiction writing is really helpful in fiction, because you have to focus on one thing and teach somebody one thing by the end of a book. And it's really good to have that focus when you are working with complex plots. You have a lot of characters. You have a lot of stuff going on. You kind of want it all to get tied up really nicely at the end. Even if your reader's mad at what you did, if you answered all the plot questions, you successfully wrote a book.
Right.
And that same thing has to apply in nonfiction writing as well. So I think it's a really nice crossover. And I actually only had the chutzpah to do the podcast because I produced my own audiobook. And that was one hell of an adventure, for sure.
Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me, like, how does that process work of doing an audiobook, recording it? Like, yeah, how does that go? Because I've never talked to anybody that's done that before.
Yeah, well, I had found a voice actor, and her voice was perfect for my main character. My main character is gender nonspecific, and she'd been smoking for a long time. She's a singer, so she can change her vocal range. And she was able to hit that mid-range just perfectly, where you're like, is this a woman with a sultry voice or a man? Like, I don't know. It was perfect. Well, she flaked out on me entirely at the very last minute. So I had 2 weeks to throw together this entire audiobook. So I would say my experience is atypical and very rushed. But the beauty of the internet, I was able to Google and YouTube exactly how to do everything from start to finish, and I made it work. I had a lot of volunteers, friends, family who did extra voices for me. I learned all about Audacity. Greatest freeware of all time.
Exactly what we use.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's what I use for the podcast now too because of that, and it was versatile. I was able to, you know, shift my pitch enough that I got in a space where people felt, "Oh, that's the character. That's good." It's the hardest, most stressful project I've ever completed. And I cried when I heard it on Audible. You know, when you go on Audible and you can like listen to like 30 seconds of a sample to see if you want to download it.
Right.
Well, I clicked it and I listened to it and I just started crying and I was like, I finished it. It's done.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
If you ever want to hear the most gender, like amazing gender non-specific voice acting.
Yes.
There is an anime that came out in the 90s called Rurouni Kenshin. And the original Japanese language voice actress for the main character is a female playing a male. And it is so cool because she hits that exact
mid-range
tone
where nice. You're
like, I think that's a female voice actress, but this is a male character. And like the idea is that he's supposed to be like kind of effeminate and not like threatening, but also like a total badass. So
cool.
Like
yeah.
It's really, really cool. Definitely. Just when you said that vocal range, that was immediately
what
mind
popped
jumped
in your head.
To.
That's cool.
So you have Offbeat Writer, like
yeah.
What you talked about is like
it's
this
my business, yeah.
This business where you help writers, you know, develop their design and like editing and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
What's the most offbeat thing you've worked on for Offbeat Writer?
The most offbeat thing I've worked on. One of my clients is a medium, and so she's writing a book full of FAQs, basically, on things that people ask her all the time in readings about dead people. Can dead people see you naked? Do they follow me everywhere? Things like that. So that's been really interesting because I would say that's pretty off-center from the norm.
Yeah.
And some of her answers and things are just, they're just fascinating and intriguing. I love all of that kind of stuff. I love the metaphysical. So I've been really enjoying that, but that's probably the most offbeat project I've worked on.
That is really, really awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds like it would also make like a really good podcast. Like,
oh yeah, she should totally do one. We need to finish this book, and then when we're done, I'm going to try to get her to do transmedia, like everything, because
I would listen to that because I listen to like Jim Harold and a lot of like the weird paranormal stuff.
Yeah,
I would totally listen to that show. So sorry, totally distracted. tell everybody what projects you're working on, like what's about to come out, and then how people can find you on social media.
Yeah, so the big project I'm working on finishing up, we're finishing up revisions for Counting Bodies Like Stars. That should be out in spring of 2019. I should have a firm published date by August. And then after that, I'm hoping to work on, I finished half of a first draft of a time travel novel called The Timekeeper's Apprentice. It's a new adult. She's 19. The main character's 19. And she is literally an apprentice for timekeeping, which they're the ones who hold the keys to making sure the fabric of time stays intact and paradoxes don't happen and you don't end up with a space-time continuum calamity and the whole universe collapses. So that's a really fun one that I'm super stoked on. Albert Einstein is one of my characters. So
nice.
That's been really, really fun to do. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to work on next. And of course, In the Mind of Revenge is a series. And so the next book is in the pipeline. I'm really hoping to have something complete with that toward the end of 2019.
Awesome. And how can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, the best way to stay in touch with me is to subscribe to my website. It's livhaddon.com. As soon as you subscribe, you'll actually get the first three chapters of In the Mind of Revenge for free. Of course, you can unsubscribe anytime, but I really don't spam people. I only email when there's something relevant and an update. So you won't hear from me for months, and then you'll get one email, and then I will leave you alone again. I don't spam people's inboxes. If you do want to find me on social, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's just at Liv Haddon. I'm most active on Instagram. If you tag me on Twitter, I'll respond. If you hop in my messages or DMs, I respond as soon as possible.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
and I'm super excited for Counting Bodies Like Stars.
Yeah, me too.
It sounds really, really good. So
it'd be rad.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So with us, we have Margaret Scott, who is a writer, and probably the distinction for you is that you are the first female writer of the Transformers, like, world whatsoever. What was that adventure like?
Yeah, so I've been told I'm the first female writer to write Transformers comics, and that was really cool because I've been writing on Transformers cartoons. I started on Transformers Prime, and it's been a crazy journey. You know, it's funny, I actually, once Till All Are One ended, that was kind of the last of my work on Transformers, ended last year or early this year. Time's weird for me right now.
Yeah.
But I've written Transformers my whole career, and it's just kind of, it's like home. It's fun. It's great. I love it.
So when you first went to write Transformers, obviously there's this huge backstory, like this broad universe that you're approaching. Like, was it kind of intimidating to like look at such a broad scope of like backstory? Like, I feel like Transformers is almost of the level of, oh, you're going to write the Avengers now. Like, there's that much information to take in.
Yeah, well, especially because IDW maintained the same continuity for so long. So everything was interlocking. It was a little intimidating, but, you know, Carlos and John, my editors, they're great. And they really had my back. And you got to try and you got to get in there and you got to have fun. And sometimes you can play with the continuity. So it's like we had the two Tankors.
Right.
Like Tall Tankor and Fat Tankor, which, by the way, almost weren't in the issue. That joke at the last minute on the first issue of Unblade, I almost cut that joke because I was like, oh, technically a robot can't be fat. And John Barber was like, no, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
So if you like Fat Tankor, that you should thank John Barber because I almost chickened out of that joke.
So is it a little easier to mess with the timeline because you can basically create time travel as a science fiction like writing tool?
Oh, I never use time. No, time travel is way more trouble than it's worth.
Awesome.
Everyone's always like, oh, you can do time travel causes so many problems. And then it's like, if you go back in time or blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Look at any X-Men comic. Time travel's not worth it.
So speaking of other properties, you've worked on everything from Wonder Woman, Guardians of the Galaxy, Spider-Man, Star Trek. Like, you've done all sorts of different projects. Is there like one property that you've always thought to yourself, man, I wish I could get my hands on that?
Oh, that's tough. That always feels weird because it feels like you're like, I want that person's job, which, you know, a lot of people are doing a lot of really great work. But I do have to say that I got to write Superman in Young Monsters in Love. And especially when Superman's a dad, I just think he's such the ultimate dad that I love writing that. It's like I want to write like that scene with Jonathan where like Jonathan's on the little league team because Superman is bringing orange slices and he has orange slices for the other team, but he leaves them in the car because he doesn't want them to feel pressured, you know, but just in case. And Superman roots for both sides. And I love that aspect of him, you know, because it lets him be happy and fun and it gives him something to protect, you know, where it's because that's always the problem with Superman is, you're not going to kill Superman, at least for very long, you know, but giving him a family gives him something to worry about losing.
So I actually had a question about the Young Monsters in Love. That whole book was just phenomenal. Like, it was such a cool idea. And like they did, every writer and artist did something really interesting and unique in the book. But the Superman, like Solomon Grundy story that you told was actually really pretty melancholy. Like it's almost, It's about love, but it's also very sad. What did you draw inspiration from to write that piece?
Well, I guess it's because, you know, they had offered me a list of sort of different... My editor, David, had kind of offered me a list of different monsters they'd been thinking of, you know, and Solomon Grundy was on the list. And I remembered reading some comic where they talked about his wife. And how, you know, Solomon Grundy, because in most of his incarnations, not all, but many of his incarnations, he's basically a nonverbal character. You don't get any of that depth. And I just thought that was such an interesting angle that Solomon Grundy had this wife. And in some versions, like, he died trying to protect his wife. And that was just so much more interesting than sort of giant Hulk zombie. And I wanted to give him a chance to sort of play with that. I thought that was an interesting different, because they talked about doing different kinds of love instead of just purely romantic love. And so I was like, that's something that's really neat.
That's awesome.
Plus, I really wanted to have someone talk about, like, actually, like, call Solomon Grundy a zombie. I thought that was great.
So when you're approaching a project like that and you have all these other, like, you know, people working on it and like all these different ideas floating around, are there ever moments where you have to like communicate with the other writers and say, hey, this is my idea. I really don't want to step on your toes, so that we're not covering the same ideas over and over again in the book?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the project. So that was a really big issue when I did IDW's big summer event, First Strike, and I ended up co-writing that with David Rodriguez. And IDW was so great because I really wanted to write the event and they really wanted me to write the event and I had a baby. And so it was like, can I get some help? And they were like, David Rodriguez, and he was the best, you know? We were really concerned about making sure that we kept all of the characters feeling like themselves in their line, but also making sure that, you know, we didn't step on any of our toes. And so actually we started writing First Strike a long time before it came out. And we had had everyone sort of write up an outline of like where their comic was going and what they thought was the most important thing about it. And I went and I tried to talk to a bunch of the guys who were writing their comics, because a lot of them were in LA, about like, you know, what do you think is most important to capture this tone of your character and to make sure that everyone felt real? Because I never like in events when, you know, you're reading one line and then you read the event book and you're like, well, they wouldn't talk like that.
Right.
You know, so it was important to me to to maintain that continuity and make sure that we weren't stepping on anyone's toes.
So as a father of four, like, I know how drastically being a parent changes, like, your attitude and, like, what you're doing. How has being a parent changed your writing?
It definitely, you definitely have to be more focused.
Right, because you have zero spare time.
Yeah, exactly. And because I worked from home until, like, a couple weeks ago. So it's like imagine, like, working in an office, but, like, every half hour, just someone starts randomly screaming.
I think I have worked in that office, if I'm really honest.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a little tough. So you have to do that. I do find that I'm a little more sensitive about violence to kids now that I have a kid. Like, before, you know, you're like, oh yeah, that's terrible. But when you actually have a kid, you're like, oh my God, like a kid. it's just a new experience. And as a writer, you try and research the lives of your characters and you want to get in their heads, but there really is something different about literally gaining a new experience firsthand. And dang, parenting is one heck of an experience.
The amount of bodily fluid that has ended up on my body is unreal. Like,
so much. And just the, like, I remember there was literally, I keep talking that I'm going to one day write a graphic novel about the first year of being a mom, because I remember literally one day he had, like, sleep regressed. So we'd cross the 4-hour mark, which is how much sleep you need to, like, feel human again, where you're like, oh my God, I can actually have thought. Like, you're still exhausted, but, like, anything less than that and you're literally just
a
zombie.
My head kills me. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Like, I just get massive headaches and hate life.
But, like, he had regressed back under 4 hours one night, and I remember laying on the bed looking up at the fan and literally hearing, like, the start of Apocalypse Now. And I was like, I'm in this moment. I literally, it's like I could almost hear the choppers, like, out of my window.
You're like, this is my Heart of Darkness right now.
Yeah, it is. Parenting is the best worst thing ever.
It's so true. That's, like, the most accurate statement I've heard about parenting in a long time. When you look at, like, your breadth of work and the things that you've done, is there something that you're excited to show your kids someday?
I'm really excited to show my kids Windblade, because Windblade was a real challenge. It's funny. We started talking about the idea of Windblade a little bit after the Boston Marathon bombing. And my husband was like, you know, he asked me to write a character that was really built on hope and that really wanted to do the right thing and didn't want to fight as a first instinct, you know, and could we actually pull it off? And in the beginning, I was actually a little skeptical, because that's not, like, for those of you that don't know, Windblade's profession is ambassador. She has some fighting ability, like, she does fight at points, but really most of the book is negotiation and relationships and political machinations. And I was like, that's not super visual. It's like, how do we make that dramatic? And I wasn't sure, and it was hard at times, but we really got it. You know, we do really cool sequences. It helps that they're robots, so we can, like, go into people's minds, and, you know, we figured out ways to, like, make it really visually interesting. But being able to show my kids a character who says they want to make the world better and then actually tries, or who says they don't want violence and actually follows through with that, I think is really important. I have written a number of shoot 'em up characters, and I love shoot 'em up characters, and those are really fun, but I think I'll be proud one day when my kids can read a hero that doesn't want to hurt people. And I think that's an important thing for them to see.
So as we're wrapping up, what kind of projects are you working on now that people should be looking out for? And then also, how can people find you on social media to keep track of what you're doing?
Yeah. I'm a consulting producer on the Guardians of the Galaxy cartoon. So that is still airing, season 3, Mission Breakout. We're very excited about that. And I'm also working on I wrote a direct-to-DVD animated feature that Marvel's putting out called Marvel Rising Secret Warriors. That's going to be out later, I think later this year at some point. So that's coming up and we're kind of buzzing about that. It's a buddy superhero movie about Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl.
Oh, so, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. It's really fun. It's so much fun. So I'm very excited about that. And then in the comics world, I'm starting up on Batgirl. And yes. That is going the opposite route. We are actually going to get a lot grittier and a lot darker. I like to think that I want to sort of take that really wonderful, hopeful Babstar Batgirl and kind of put her back in that kind of gritty Gail Simone world, you know, and kind of like bridge those two. So we're going to put Batgirl a little bit through the ringer, but hopefully she'll, you know, Gordons don't give up. So she's going to fight through it.
To a gross excess if you watch Gotham.
I don't watch Gotham. I won't get into it. Okay.
No worries. And then how can people find you on social media?
Oh, yes. So you can find me on Twitter at Margaret Scott or on my website, which is mscottwriter.com. You can sign up. I also do a monthly newsletter there, which is really fun. It helps you keep track of my stuff. But also we like try and throw in a little bit of tidbits. So this last month we threw in the playlist that I listen to whenever I write Batgirl.
Nice.
So you can hear about that. So if you want like little insidery info on that, or we'll do like comics recommendations or things. And
very cool.
So yeah, so find me online.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate having you on the show. Sorry I bumbled the entire first 2 minutes of it.
We are all right there with you, man. And it's Denver. It's the thin air. It's not helping.
Oh, I'm always here. Like it's always thin air for me. So I'm used to it.
I was throwing you a bone.
Oh, I know. I know. And then I was just like, no, it's me being stupid. Awesome. Well, thanks again. We really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
All right, guys, back on the floor of Denver Comic Con, we are talking with Sonia Anwar.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
I am doing really, really well. So you have kind of made a name for yourself basically as like a freelance artist. You do a ton of covers and a lot of like really cool variants, but you also are working with Betty and Veronica Vixens, with the Archie books and all that sort of stuff. What is it like kind of getting into the world of comic books right now?
It's really cool. I mean, to be honest, I feel like I'm in the best era to be getting into comics because, you know, there isn't as much, I think, gatekeeping as there used to be. Now I'm at a point where, you know, someone who looks like myself and works like myself is able to get into the industry. And the fact that so many people out there from Archie, from Valiant, from Vertigo have reached out to me after seeing my independent book and my independent work, I think goes to show that, like, you know, the face of the industry is changing a little bit and there's more room for people at the table, which is really cool.
That is awesome. So talk to us a little bit about your independent book. So is it called 1001? Is that right?
Yeah. So okay. It's called 1001.
All right. Didn't want to call it like 1001, sound like a crazy person or something.
You know what? It's funny. I'm pretty sure people will inevitably call it that too. And when that happens, I'll pivot and say the book is somehow about a cyber apocalypse.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, so it's loosely based on 1001 Arabian Nights. So it's about a woman captured by a mad king, and the only way to keep herself alive is to tell him stories, but always leave it on a cliffhanger, and try to bring him out of his madness while keeping herself from being killed.
That's awesome. So when you're approaching something like kind of as pivotal as 1001 Arabian Nights, which has been pivotal for hundreds of years as like literature, like how do you approach that without feeling overwhelmed?
Well, you know, it's definitely a really good question. And I think the biggest thing to be overwhelmed by is the sheer scope of the series, because it really is so many stories. And I very often have people stop by and make the joke, are you going to do all 1001 nights? And the answer to that is definitely not. Actually, I focus mostly on the framework story of Sherazad, who is the storyteller. So by focusing more in on her and the characters around the stories, it lets me kind of like narrow the scope and really work on what I want to focus on while still dotting it with some interesting stuff.
That's awesome. So your artistic style, like, is very, like, it's very graphic. It feels very graphic while also being like incredibly highly detailed. Like, what is your approach like going into a piece like a cover or something like that?
You know, strangely enough, you might not think by looking at my work, but the biggest initial point of inspiration for me is color. Usually I'll see a color in a color scheme somewhere in my life, you know, walking down the street or in a sunset or in a night sky or what have you. And my immediate first reaction is, I got to make that into an artwork somehow. And that always is the first note in the song that makes up the artwork. After that, I start asking myself about the narrative. Then after the narrative, it's the costuming and all that other good stuff. So, yeah, that's really how I kind of put together my pieces, starting from a little bit of an unusual takeoff point.
That's awesome. So, obviously, like, as a person of color that wears, like...
The headscarf.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not sure exactly what it's called right now. I'm sure if I was at home, I would have just looked it up on Google. But how is it, like, obviously, you were on the cultural consciousness panel that
yes.
I moderated. So we talked a little bit about, like, internet trolls and things like that. But, like, how do you just, like, do you feel over-obligated to present yourself as, like, a kind, nice person to people?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And nobody ever asks me that, but that is so true. There's definitely, I mean... When I'm at a show, it's not a challenge because I'm having so much fun and
right.
I love talking to people. And these are literally my people, comics people. So I don't feel that pressure here. But out in my day-to-day life, there's a feeling that like if somebody, you know, says something harshly to me on the street or somebody cuts me off in traffic or whatever else, that like I don't have the right to get angry because I'm representing more than just myself.
Right.
You know, and yeah, there's really a sense that you must be on a supreme behavior. And, you know, sometimes that can be a bit stressful, but at the same time, I'd like to think that one of the reasons I wear the headscarf is so people can talk to me and learn a bit more about me, where I come from, my culture, my faith, and just to help bridge the gaps to let everybody know that we are all on this planet together to have compassion for each other and care for each other. So
that's awesome. Like, I've always kind of wondered about that because there's... You know, as like a bigger guy that like wears a battle vest and like, you know, maybe looks a little intimidating to people, sometimes I realize that I have to be way nicer to people so that they're not just,
you know,
terrified.
Like.
Yeah. But you're a pretty nice lady. You're like, you know, young and attractive and all of those things. So I feel like it's such a bizarre thing for somebody to feel intimidated just because you're wearing a piece of clothing. Like, it's a strange situation to me.
You know,
so.
It is. And it's the funniest part of all is you very quickly learn there's some jokes you are never going to be able to make again. I was in an interview earlier and somebody asked if they could move my purse to the side. And I was about to make the joke like, oh, be careful. There's a bunch of like crazy stuff in there. And then I realized that could actually be construed as true. And I didn't make that joke.
On our show, you can make that joke,
well,
by the way.
And I will next time. So, yeah, it's a funny world living and censoring yourself. And I think I'm not the only one who does that. I think a lot of people who traditionally are coming from backgrounds where they are perceived a certain way, especially if they're coming from backgrounds where they're perceived as more negative, they work harder to try to combat that, whether they should have to or not.
That's awesome. So on top of being Muslim, you're also a female.
I am.
And you're crazy, right? And your artwork features a lot of like really strong, like female figures. You know, do you feel like because of who you are that you pull that out of yourself, or is it just, I guess what I'm trying to say is it a conscious choice or is it just kind of what people ask you to draw?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think I've always had a tendency to draw more women because I love drawing detailing and costuming and jewelry. And there's never been as much opportunity with male characters to do that, although wonderfully that's changing. So, you know, for myself, that was just a natural inclination. And I think over time they started to have this feeling of like, strength and a sort of like dynamic quality or a little bit of a strange sultry mystery to them. So yeah, I think it was just kind of a bit of an organic process, but definitely I want every woman I create, every character I create to have something behind their eyes, have a mentality, because when I draw them, there's always a narrative in my mind, whether I share that or not.
So I've been kind of asking this of all the people that I've talked to that are working on the Archie books. So you're entering like this world that it has a lot of preconceived notions, that's trying to turn itself on its head, but has like a very distinctive visual aesthetic. How in the world do you approach drawing Betty and Veronica when there's literally billions of Betty and Veronica panels?
Well, you know, it's actually really interesting because I kind of won the lottery on this because, you know, I've been working with Archie and they approached me and said, do you want to do some covers for Betty and Veronica Vixens? And this is a comic about Betty and Veronica as women in a motorcycle gang.
Right.
And suddenly the doors are thrown wide open for I can do almost anything as long as it falls under the branch of cool punk girls on motorcycles. So for me, I got lucky. I got to take these characters and do, you know, almost anything I wanted with them. And I think that is one of the cooler things that Archie's doing, that because they're writing different kinds of books now, we're having the opportunities to draw things with these characters that we've never been able to before. So yeah, indeed, there is a very like strict Betty and Veronica history, but now we're getting the chance to play with it, which is cool.
So I was talking to Terry Moore of Strangers in Paradise earlier today.
Terry Moore.
Right. Huge idol of mine.
Mine too.
So he had a picture in one of his sketchbooks that had a motorcycle. And he talked about how awful it was to draw the front wheel in perspective.
Oh my gosh.
How's your motorcycle wheels?
Okay, let me unpack that for a moment, if I may. I draw very organic things. I don't do a lot of like structural things. You don't see me doing a lot of robots, things like that. So suddenly to start doing motorcycles, I kind of realized, I'm like, I have to find a way to love this. Because if I don't, it's going to show up in the work. So I thought, well, you know, let's look at what kind of motorcycles I like. And I thought I'd really like to channel a bit more of the grittier, old school stuff, the military motorcycles, the Kawasaki motorcycles, the, you know, the kind of Che Guevara era.
Like a cafe bike.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, I'm going to start there. And Sean Murphy's work was also a big inspiration because he's a huge motorcycle nut. And I think the most intimidating thing was there's so much, you know, so much of the organs are right on display when it comes to a motorcycle. So you have to sort of pick and choose what you're going to show and what you're not. And that was a bit of a challenge. But I have to turn around and say I've come to like drawing motorcycles. Do I draw the wheel in perspective well? No. But I'm faking it pretty well.
That's awesome. So when you're approaching something that's like so different for you, do you like really dig into research and like pictures and things like that to look at?
I do and I don't. Much like again with the motorcycles, it depends a lot on how much I think I can, you know, get it to mesh with my own style. If it's something really far out of my stylistic range, I try to approach it in a more creative way to have it, you know, synthesize more with my stuff. But sometimes you really just have to, like, again, with the motorcycles, open your mind a bit more and ask, like, how can I make this mine? If you look how I've done it in Vixens, I've got them covered in, like, the motorcycles are covered in stickers and all kinds of, like, neat little details and juicy bits for the viewer to find. And that was my way of throwing my love into it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, when I have material that I'm unfamiliar with and a little freaked out by, I just have to find where to draw out the thing that I can love.
That's awesome. So tell our listeners like what projects you're working on right now and how they can find you on the internet, and just basically so they can follow what I assume is kind of just the start of what's going to be an amazing career.
Oh gosh, I really hope so. Well, basically, you know, again, I'm Sonia Anwar, and you can visit my website, Art by Sonia, SanAsAnancyYA.com. And from there, you'll be able to get to my Twitter, Instagram, all that fun stuff. And right now I'm working more on Betty and Veronica Vixens. We're wrapping that up. We have a new undisclosed project coming out. I'm also part of the DC Writers Alumni Group.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
Yeah, so really cool. We're a bunch of young writers trained by DC. And we'll be doing our talent showcase at the end of the year where I get to work on a DC IP of my choice, which is very, very cool. Can't say what that is just yet.
Can you whisper it in my ear after the interview?
I definitely can't say that I did.
Yeah.
And beyond that, you'll always see me working on my comic 1001. I work on Assassin's Creed as well. And I have another little very, very special project coming out with Titan that I think you're going to be really excited by. Can't say anything, but awesome. Do keep an eye open for it.
Well, how about this? Maybe when you can say things, you come back on the show for a longer interview. How's that sound?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Well,
really appreciate
it. Pleasure to be here.
All right. Hey, everybody, especially our Patreon supporters. This is going to go to you guys before anybody else. I am sitting here with Daryl McDaniels, a.k.a. DMC of Run DMC fame. But we're going to talk to you today about comic books.
Yes, comic books.
So tell us a little bit about DMC and like what you're doing going forward to create effectively a whole new comic book company.
Well, 3 years ago, I went to meet a young man named Riggs Morales up at Atlantic Records. And Riggs Morales is somebody who worked with Eminem for the rise of the Shady Record Empire. Big shout out to Riggs and big shout out to Eminem because Eminem loves comic books.
Oh, nice.
So I go to meet Riggs, and Riggs says he's really professional guy. Yo, I'm usually very professional. I never fan out. But, and he used these words, DMC, man, you was like my superhero, man, the way you looked and the way you sound and all of that. And he just asked me, what was it like when I was a little kid? And I was like, well, I went to Catholic school, and all I did was read, collect, and draw comic books. He was like, comic books? And I was like, yeah, comic books. He said, comic books? And I was like, yeah, comic books. We sat there for 3 hours and we talked about comic books.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I grew up in Queens, New York. He grew up in the Bronx, Puerto Rican kid from the Bronx. Found out that we had more in common than just hip hop. So then he was like, just blown away. Me and my brother had a huge collection of Marvel comic books that the majority of mine disappeared. Well, they didn't disappear. When hip hop came over the bridge in the 70s, all the kids was getting turntables. So me and my brother, we had a problem. We didn't sell weed, so we had no money. So if you was the local neighborhood weed dealer, you could get turntables and all that. So we had this huge comic book collection. So my brother was like, yo, let's do a comic book or sale so we could get two turntables in the mixer. So we did that, and fortunately that worked out. But after speaking to Riggs, Riggs was like, yo, this is crazy. You should do a comic book. And I said, no. He was like, why not? I was like, I don't want to be another rapper thinking just because I got a hit record I could do everything. Because hip-hop has a habit of going into other genres and just doing it for commercial means and to make money and, you know, draw all the money out of it and then totally forget about the culture. So Riggs was like, oh, that's very honorable of you, DMC, but yours is different because comic books is your first love. Comic books is the thing that gave me confidence to get up on that stage and become the devastating mind controller, to become the king of rock, to become the son of Bifrid. The whole son of Bifrid thing came from this. I was sitting there one day, Thor is the son of Odin from Asgard. He got a brother named Loki. He got a father named Odin, and he has a hammer. In this realm here, I'm Daryl. I'm from Hollis. I got a brother named Alfred, and I got a mic. So I became, on this earth, son of Bifrid, brother of Al. Banner's my mother and Run's my pal. It's McDaniels, not McDonald's. These rhymes are Daryl's. Those burgers are Ronald's. I ran down my family tree, my mother, my father, my brother, and me. So comic books gave me the confidence to tell stories about the most powerful entity in the hip-hop universe. So that being said, Rick said, with this book, you can do the same thing you've been doing with your music all these 30 years. I was like, what are you talking about, Riggs? He said, inspire, motivate, educate, and entertain. And I was like, wow. So comic books was the thing that gave me confidence in life as a kid. I went to Catholic school my whole life. I got teased and bullied because I was in Catholic school. Nowadays, it's cool to wear glasses, but coming up, my whole life was, hey, four eyes, hey, spectacles, hey, binoculars. You know what I'm saying? So here I am, a Catholic school kid that wore glasses who was in the comic books, was this geeky, nerdy kid. So my life was traumatic as a little kid. But comic books was that release for me, that escape for me. I saw a lot of myself in those characters. You know what I'm saying? And Marvel did something fantastic to set me up for hip-hop. Because Marvel taught me in this life here, you define yourself with an adjective. I don't care who you are and what you're going through. This is how you pull your power out. You define yourself with an adjective and you tell the world who you are, for instance. If I say The Amazing, you'll say
Spider-Man.
If I say Incredible, you'll say
Hulk.
And if I say The Mighty, you'll say
Thor.
Right. So I was like, whoa, that's all you got to do? So when I was doing this hip-hop thing, Daryl McDaniels is who I am. Mild-mannered Daryl McDaniels. The initials of my name is DMC. But that all changes when I touch this microphone and I'm transformed into the Mighty King of Rock. Now DMC now becomes the devastating, mic-controlling King of Rock. So all of those characterizations, storytelling, words, because I was reading every day, I was a straight-A student. I did all my work. I excelled in school because I was reading every day. And I come from a generation where the educators were like, the kids need to read their textbooks and workbooks. True. They do need to read the textbooks and workbooks. But in my generation, the educators overlooked the fact, even though it was a comic book, I was reading every day. Now, they thought a comic book couldn't do no good for me. It did better than some of the textbooks. Why? Because our imagination is the most powerful gift that was given to us. Albert Einstein, the smartest man in history, in the universe, said imagination is more important than knowledge. Why? You could have all the knowledge you want, but without imagination, it doesn't manifest.
Right.
So I got all this imagination and creativity in me, which made me in school. I learned about World War II. It's cool. But Captain America takes me there.
Right. And you get to fight Nazis like alongside
him. Yes, and you learn about what was really going on in there. I learn about the sun and the moon and stars and science, but the Silver Surfer takes me there.
That's awesome.
And when you read in these comic books, you physically, emotionally, and spiritually feel emotions.
Right.
You get happy, you get sad, you feel exhilarating. So Ray said, yo, let's do something that's going to be a tribute and a celebration of what makes comics incredible to every generation.
So with like the advent of like Black Panther as a movie, like obviously it brings like black culture and nerd culture out into the forefront.
Exactly.
And there's always been a lot of that, like Afrofuturism with guys like Afrika Bambaataa and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. How it's always been there.
Like how does it feel? Because there was a transition for me too. I was a nerdy kid that got picked on, and now that's pop culture.
So yeah, it's cool. You've been cool.
Yeah, I've been cool.
Everybody else that was picking on you, those were the uncool ones.
How does it feel to not just be able to embrace your nerd culture, but also like black nerd culture?
Well, it feels good because even with any of the arts, art, drawing, writing, storytelling, journalism, sculpting, painting, you know, the arts succeeds where politics and religion fails. So hip hop was this urban, social, underground culture that people didn't think was going to last.
Right. It was a fad.
Even in the beginning, you know what I'm saying? Even in the beginning, people was like, you know, Walk This Way was killing, but they were still Run DMC. Where do you think you'll be in 5 years? But they didn't know culture means life. It's a way of life. So to be able to see the growth in the seeds that were planted now sprouting into major forests, technology, creativity, cinema, literature, an opportunity for us geeks and nerds is one of the most gratifying things ever. And I can really relate to what the Black Panther and stuff is doing, because when you look at hip hop itself, people say this. In that Walk This Way video, when Steven Tyler took that mic stand and knocked down the wall that was separating y'all, that didn't just happen in a video, it happened in the world.
Yeah.
That the director, John Small, had no idea how prophetic he was with that move. You know, they showed us on each different sides of the wall, and then Steven takes the mic stand and knocks down the wall, and it brings us together. When I look at what's going on with the geek and nerd culture, it's bringing more people together because, like you said, there were little things that were on the forefront, but everybody else was still in a closet because a lot of geeks and nerds thought we felt good being geeks and nerds, but our perception was in the real world, this isn't cool.
Right.
But now we're starting to realize that we're the really cool ones, and it's the real world that's really not cool. You know, when you look at the X-Men, you know, it was a symbolic of racism and bias and hate, and, you know, because they're different from us and they're scared and stuff like that. You know, Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, They said there's no way these black hip hoppers is going to get with these white punk rockers and something good is going to come out of it. But Run DMC and the Beastie Boys, we toured the world together and brought people together. We brought the – and here's what's deep about speaking musically. When we put out Rock Box, King of Rock and Walk This Way, there was a lot of black kids who wasn't into soul music. They were in the metal.
Yeah.
They were in the punk. But they wouldn't walk through the hood and say, yo, I'm down with this because – Hip-hop itself would have dissed them.
Right.
But when Run DMC put it for the world to see, it gave validation to all of us. And now we realize that geek and nerd culture makes this world go round. We create all the stories. We create all the books. We create all the novels. We create all the technology. We create all the movies. We create all the phones. We create everything that the world needs to survive. It's because of us.
Right.
It's
awesome listening to you talk about doing the Walk This Way video, because I grew up like really into punk and really into metal, and I would have antagonistic relationships with people just because they liked hip hop. Right. Like just because they liked rap. And
for sure.
You know, you would call it.
Because it ain't music.
It's just crap without the C.
Yep.
Rap is crap. Yeah, rap is crap.
Oh, for sure.
And then you came out with that video, and I just remember thinking, well, maybe it's not that bad. And opened up my mind to something else. Do you feel like DMC as a comic book and like as a comic book company is going to have that ability to say, look at all these different ideas. Let's do the exact same thing with
comics.
Yep,
that's exactly what Rick said we are going to do.
That's awesome.
It's exactly the same. He said, you can do exactly what you've done with your music all these years and more. And the whole thing of who better to do it through a culture that feels like some of the people creatively feel. You know what I'm saying? A lot of times we question ourselves, but we will always succeed as geeks and nerds because people don't realize we are products of pop culture.
Right.
Like me sitting here, I'm Bruce Lee. The 60s Godzilla films. I'm Fred Flintstone. I'm George Jefferson. I'm Woody Woodpecker. I'm Bugs Bunny and Looney Tunes. I'm the Brady Bunch. I'm the Monsters. I'm the Addams Family. I'm Lost in Space. I'm Space 1999 and Star Trek. As a little kid, I come home from school. I'm reading my comic books. When my mother says, eat your dinner first, and then you can watch TV, I turn it on. There's a story of a lovely lady. I'm Tony Nelson looking at Jeannie's boobs. I mean, most of the kids when we was little, everybody watched I Dream of Jeannie. We thought we was looking for it for the story. No, Jeannie was beautiful. You know what I'm saying? So we are that. Everything pop. I was so attracted to the characters in these comic books, not knowing that my life literally is a superhero story. Rick says, D, you got everything a superhero has. You got two identities. Your mild-mannered Darryl McDaniels, who transforms into the mighty King of Rock. You wear glasses. You have two looks. You know, I'm sitting here like this, but then I put on my Batman suit, the glasses, the hat, the gold chain, the Adidas suits. This is some superhero stuff. When I was 35 years old, this is some superhero stuff. When I was 35 years old, I woke up one day and I wanted to kill myself. True story. I was just depressed. And I didn't know why. And I looked at my life. Okay, Byford and Banner's my mother, father. Alpha's my brother. Run and Jay's my friends. This thing called hip-hop. My Adidas, Walk This Way. And I summed up my whole life on earth up to the age 35, and something was missing. And I couldn't put my finger on it. There was a void in me. And the void hurt so much that I wanted to jump off a building. And I went up to the roof of a building. I was getting ready to jump. But then I said, oh, if I jump now and die, people know the Run DMC story. They don't know about Darryl McDaniels, the little boy that made all this possible. So I said, before I kill myself, I want to let the world know, yo, what's up, world? I'm Darryl McDaniels. You know me as DMC from the groundbreaking rap group Run DMC. First to go gold. First to go platinum. First on the color of Rolling Stone. First with the sneaker deals. First with the big tours. Everything hip-hop is doing, they say it's because of me running J. But I'm really just Darryl McDaniels, born May 31st, 1964. And that's all I knew about my birthday. So I called my moms up to make it. I say, Mom, I know my birthday is May 31st, 1964. I just need a few details about the day I was born to make it more interesting for the reader. How much did I weigh? What hospital? What time? She told me. Hung up the phone. An hour goes by. At this point in my life, I'm an alcoholic. Remember, Tony Stark was alcoholic in the books. So all of this stuff started coming to me. I'm an alcoholic, metaphysical, suicide, spiritual wreck who don't know what's going on with me. You know what I'm saying? They called back an hour later, my mother and my father. It was like, we have something else to tell you, son. And I was like, okay, what is it? I thought it was going to be something trivial and nostalgic. You was a month old when we brought you home and you're adopted, but we love you. Bye. Click. It was some super. It's a son. We have. You're not really from this planet. So think about that. I've come DMC, all of this, the dual identities, everything that attracted me to this comic books was me. So there's a lot of us in these characters. Why do you think my whole career, I told you, I'm DMC, I come from Queens, I'm the king from Queens, I live in Queens, because Peter Parker lived in Queens. When I heard that, it was the coolest thing, Peter Parker, so it made it all real to me. So those things began to manifest. So it's our responsibility, like, to do what you do, to journal all of this, and let people come and speak so other people who feel alone and defeated and downgraded and not worthy to be here can say, I am not alone. There's a multitude of people like me. So for me, it feels gratifying. When I first got into hip-hop, most of the rappers was talking about jail and gangbanging and selling drugs. I never did none of that stuff. I read comic books. But I was able to take what people thought was uncool, my glasses. For all the kids who ever said, four-eye spectacles and binoculars, you blind as a bat, I was able to get on a microphone and say, D's for doing it all of the time. M's for the rhymes that are on mine. C's for cool, cool as can be. And Ron would say, why you wear those glasses? Now I go, so I can see. I didn't wear them to be cool. I didn't wear them to be fashionable. I wore them because I needed them to see. But that weakness, I was able to proclaim artistically and creatively that it was the most dominant thing on the face of the earth. So it feels real good for me to come back to my roots. If I never had comic books, I wouldn't be sitting here. That's I'd probably awesome. Be working a 9-to-5 with 8 kids in the house. But comic books gave me the confidence to be who I wanted.
So when you're talking about, like, you know, knowing that there's a culture out there, that there's a group out there that, it, you know, is enjoying and part of the same things that you love, you know, comic books and rap, you know, all of these other
crazy,
things.
That's crazy, right.
When you come to a convention, like, how validating is it to see, like, literally thousands and thousands of people embracing that culture?
It's crazy, because here at the conventions, it's crazy. I get, what are you doing here? These are people that didn't look at the brochure.
Yeah.
What are you doing here? I have a comic book. You don't know what that does to them.
Right.
Because they just thinking I'm the baddest entity because of the music. And I grew up, I heard your music in high school, this and that. Now it goes deeper than that. It's the same thing that happened to Riggs. We thought hip-hop was just, we did having a music meeting. We're right. going to figure out how to put out new positive rap music, but we spoke for 3 hours and didn't talk about music. We talked about comic books. So it's validating for me, but imagine what it's doing to those people.
Right.
The 50 people that I saw here today, standing on my line, looking at me, I can't believe DMC is in the comic books like me.
Yeah.
I mean, and then I'm standing here saying, I can't believe y'all letting me be down with y'all. You know what I'm saying? So it works both ways, because one of the reasons why I didn't want to do the book was I didn't want to offend none of the fellow geeks and nerds. We're very critical.
Yes. I'm a jerk.
We're very critical. We get mad at you. You know what I'm saying? Marvel is lucky they're doing good with the movies. We got to be telling DC, y'all got to get it right. And Marvel, next time you'll do Fantastic Four, it better be 10 times better than Black Panther.
Listen to that.
How could you mess up Fantastic Four? You got Ben Grimm. You got the Thing and the straight Reed Richards and Invisible. Get it right. So we're very critical. I didn't want to offend y'all because this culture, comic books, is a way of life. Just like I would never do anything to disrespect hip-hop. So now, coming from the Black culture thing, at one time, the beauty in this is at one time, hip-hop was just considered Black ghetto music. It's coming from the inner cities, and it's these gangbangers and drug dealers who got together and did something creative and positive.
The news calls it urban now. Just
yeah, it's the urban music and stuff like that. But the beauty out of that urban music, think about the think about the variety.
Right.
The varieties of expression in hip-hop. Run DMC, Grandmaster Flash, Public Enemy, Tribe Called Quest, Coogee Rap, and Polo, De La Soul. See that diversity there?
Right.
So what hip-hop had done diversely with music, I want to do for comic books, but I want the industry itself to understand, let's make it more diverse by including other ethnicities and other stories to tell. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I was just on a panel with the guy, the Asian guy who did, what's his name? His last name is Clark. But I was just on a panel with him, and he was talking about, you know, you really don't see Asians there. But me growing up, I saw Asians a lot. I saw Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee's like a god to me. Wu-Tang did something beautiful with the urban culture. When Wu-Tang first came out, there was people that didn't like hip-hop. But those people that didn't like hip-hop now like hip-hop, not because Wu-Tang is dope, but because Wu-Tang started mentioning the movies they
right.
see. That's the connection. You know what I'm saying? When DMC says, it's Christmas time in Hollis, Queens, mom's cooking chicken and collard greens, rice and stuff and macaroni and cheese, visually and emotionally, you know what that is. So right away you can relate to me and be connected. You know what I'm saying? And that's what's happening right now because of what the Black Panther's doing, because of what I'm trying to do with my book. But those are just the seeds now. I want to open the floodgates. You know what I'm saying?
That's awesome. So tell all of our listeners and our viewers for this one, how can we find DMC and you guys on social media?
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right. That's tricky. The website is dmc-comics.com. The Twitter is at DMCMakesComics.
Okay.
And the Instagram is at Daryl Makes Comics. But you can find the book in any comic book store globally.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're distributed by Diamond.
Awesome.
Who treats us really, really good because they're excited. And, you know, I work Amy Chu as my head writer. And I've worked from everybody. I worked with everybody from Ken Lashley to Bill Sienkiewicz to Umberto Ramos to some of the best people in the business who are making me feel accepted because they're excited about the possibilities of what's going on. Black Panther was just the lighting of the fuse.
Yeah, I you know agree what I'm with that.
And you know, as a kid growing up, like I was the beauty about diverse presentations is when I was growing up on a radio station. 77 WABC, they played Jackson 5. They played Sly and the Family Stone. They played James Brown. But because they played Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Bob Dylan, I was exposed to it. So when I got in the hip-hop business, I didn't want to just be the king of rap. It gave me a higher aspirations. I'm going for Elvis Presley's jugular. I want Mick Jagger to bow when I walk in the room. So I wanted to be the king of rock. You know what I'm saying? But like most of my friends, they were soul music and funk music. I was like, yo, Metallica's crazy. You know what I'm saying? Rancid is amazing. You're like, my whole thing is Pearl Jam, Rage Against the Machine, anything with a guitar and a loud drum. So that's why I wanted to be the king of rock. So if I can have that, if Run DMC and Walk This Way can knock down a door and have that type of influence, not just on music, on culture in general, we change fashion. We change relationship of black people and white people. Like my man Rick said, imagine what we're going to be doing with these books and these movies and these films and these TV shows and toys. It's an experience. We're not just living in a fantasy land. The last thing I want to say is those words make believe are powerful. Because if you make believe you're something, you will become it. I was just making believe I was the king of rock. I said it on the ready. Down with the king. I'm the king of rock, King DMC. Now when I walk the earth, what do people call me?
DMC. And with that, I just want to thank you so much for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, guys.
I cannot wait to read your book, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're recording now.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm tired.
I know you're tired. All right, so it's day 3.
Yes.
Denver Comic Con.
Correct.
Gonna wrap this bitch up.
Yes.
Okay. One.
Father's Day. You're whining about Father's Day. So.
Let's not talk about that. We're not talking about that. Sophia, don't engage. Juan. Stop it.
Let's go, whinies.
No. Okay. So general thoughts. How was the con?
It was good. It was tiring as fuck, but we did a ton. We did a lot more than we did last year, and we did a lot last year.
Yeah. I mean, it's been like kind of a whirlwind this year.
Yeah.
Like we kind of walked into it with the same level of, you know, commitment that we had last year, where we did a lot of work and we interviewed a lot of people. And then this year it just ratcheted up one notch.
Right.
Like it's been absolutely phenomenal to be able to like sit down with some of the people we've sat
right.
down with.
And I mean, I told Margaret this yesterday, you know, for all the time that we probably have to go look at things on the showroom floor, we're not here for that. We're here to work. You know, that's what it is, essentially. And
yeah.
so that's how I feel. We're here to
that's
work.
That's how I feel, too.
And we're here to do as much coverage as we can. Right, right.
So what was the highlight?
Well, I mean, the DMC interview, it has to be the highlight.
Right. Well, I mean, it was unreal, right?
Yeah.
It was, like, one of the most amazing experiences that I've had, like, not just doing this, but, like, in podcasting.
Right.
Like, it's been phenomenal. Obviously, that's number one. Let's say, what are the two other things that were the biggest highlights for you?
I don't know. I just did all of my photo ops pretty much today. So we took a photo with Billy Piper and John Barrowman, and then one with David Tennant, and then who else did I do today? Sean Gunn. What did I do yesterday? David Harbour. Yeah, I mean it's all fun. It's all good. Yeah, the Matty Cardaropoulo interview was really good. He was funny.
And that's all that matters
yeah.
to us. If you can make me laugh, it's worth it.
All the other stuff is cool. You know more about them than I do. So when people are like, "Who are you interviewing?" This person, they're like, "Oh, who's that?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Gabe told me to get him, so we try to get him." So
I would definitely say that Terry Moore was like a huge highlight for me too.
Right?
Like, just,
I couldn't hear that one, so
yeah,
I don't know.
He's a very quiet man, but he's very funny, and like it, you know, much like his comics, it ended up being less about like what's going on in his life and his work, and more about just like, hey, here's these random like social moments and like how it's fun to be awkward sometimes and like is really cool. How he writes serial killers just as good as romantic interests. Like I thought that was a little creepy. But
well, I mean they go hand in hand.
Yeah, this is true. Like, you can't be a secret lover without the secret.
Right.
Yeah. So
could write a good romance novel and then somebody dies at the end.
Yeah, it'd be fun. Stabby, stabby. A lot of good panels, a lot of good interviews, a lot of amazing cosplay, a lot of just fun in general. It was a really good convention.
What do you think about the panels?
So I think they try to do too many. I think it thins out the crowd a lot of the time. I enjoy doing them mostly because it's a chance in a lot of ways for me to interview like five people at
right.
once. And that's really awesome. Like I get a chance to hear like five or six different people talk about a subject and I can just ask them questions and they answer them. It's
right.
a lot of fun. Just like doing the interviews is a lot of fun. Sometimes they're duds. Sometimes they're awesome. But I think there might be like, does there really need to be two panels about this one subject?
Right.
You know, like, can we condense it into one so that more people go to that one?
Right.
You know? But I don't know.
I feel like maybe it would pare down the amount of time and programming they have. But when you're running a David Tennant panel, you probably shouldn't run any other ones.
Yeah.
Or maybe one or two. But, I mean, most of the people are going to be drawn to the big panel.
I definitely know that we ran a panel that was parallel, like literally parallel room-wise, like right across the hallway from Ron Perlman.
Oh, really?
So
oh, I didn't know
what
that.
What are you going to do? Like, my daughter is literally kicking my arm up to move the mic closer to my mouth because you put that in
well,
her brain.
It's you. You should just do it. Why do you do this?
Because
this makes no sense.
Because it's naturally where...
Have you ever watched anybody who has a microphone hold it way over here?
I'm lazy.
So move your head. There you go. That's good.
Anyway, I just... Like you said, like, why have a panel right across the hallway from Ron Perlman? Why not just open up more rooms to that and maybe run
right.
something else somewhere else? Like,
right.
it's just, But there's not a whole lot you can do about that.
Like, I get it because you're not, because not everybody's here for those big names, but most people are, I think.
Right.
You know, so you're never going to, the roller derby panel is never going to have a lot of people.
Especially when John Barrowman is happening at the same time.
And like, so it's just a weird timing issue. And again, maybe that's, you know, they're not going to listen to me or any of us, you know, but maybe it's just a facet of you. Maybe you need to just have less stuff going on.
But in general, I think it was a really good con.
Very good.
So
thank you to the Denver Press people.
Yeah.
Jason and Margaret. Those are the two that have helped us so far.
And
I think there's one other one, but I don't think I've ever spoken to her.
But we really appreciate all the opportunities that you've given us. We love coming to Denver Comic Con. We can't wait to do it next year. And onward and upward, like, we're about a month away from San Diego. Oh. So look forward to that, guy.
What are you? We got 18 hours in a car.
Oh, yeah, that'll be fine.
Like, I'm not too worried. Good. I might drive the whole way.
I'm going to sleep the whole way. So
no.
I'm just kidding. I'll
help. I need somebody to keep me awake.
I'll help. Don't worry.
Anything you're excited about that show?
I'm excited to be there. Like, right now, that's my excitement level. Like,
it's
I've never
be
been.
Intense.
I'm super nervous. I have 2 days by myself to start out with, and I'm like.
And that's the thing. So I was talking about that earlier because I don't. Aside from the showroom floor itself, I don't know the layout.
Yeah.
You know, here we've done a little bit here and there and done panels and things like that. I don't know where the room is that I just booked. I have not the fucking slightest idea. So we need to figure that, you know what I mean? Those are just weird little
There's weird things logistical that you, things that make me nervous.
Right.
But especially the 2 days when I'm by myself, I feel, so the way I explain it to people is like, you're the gun and I'm the bullet. Like, you point me in the right direction and I fire off the questions, you know?
Right.
And like, and without you, I'm nervous because, like, where the fuck am I going?
Buddy,
who am I talking to? What time is it?
I'm with you. It happened this morning. Like, I don't – who the fuck do I get to do this thing that we really need to do? But I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. You know what I mean?
You can. I just don't want to. Yeah.
It's not that I don't want to. It's that I just – I don't do well at those things.
And I understand
you know
that.
What I mean?
I'm not – there's no part of me that ever mocks your lack of desire to do that, because for this is my part. I don't want to email all these people. That is not my part. You know, my part is to come on mic and talk. But let's wrap this guy up. This is Gabe.
That sounded weird.
This is Gabe.
I'm Juan. God, you always do this so backwards.
Oh, cool.
I don't like
it. Okay, fine. Fuck you, Juan. Okay, if you've made it to the end of this show, which I find shocking because it's going to
be
long.
It's going to be long. It might be 3 episodes for all I know.
Hey, I'm fine with that. But
that means that we're going to get tattoos earlier than expected.
I like it. I just talked to my tattoo artist.
Nice.
He just walked by. That was that big, gigantic-looking guy
the guy that stopped
you?
Nice.
So if you are looking for more about us, you can find us at www.totlb.com. You can find us on Twitter or Instagram at Outside Longbox. Yuki's going to do a dance too.
Yeah, she's like river dancing or something.
If you are a creator, we'd love to hear from you. We love talking to independent creators. We love talking to not independent creators.
Yeah.
We just want to talk to you.
I want to talk to everybody.
You can do that by emailing us at outsidethelongbox@gmail.com. You can give us a phone call at
973-6148. Yep.
Oh, man. I almost transposed those first 3 numbers. Michael Kirk Memorial Hotline. May he rest in peace. His ghost comments on our posts all the time. It's amazing.
Colorado Springs is after San Diego.
Yeah. San Diego Comic-Con in July. Colorado Springs Comic-Con in August. Look forward to those episodes.
And then I'm off to Cuba.
Man. And hopefully we hear some stuff about Cuba.
We'll see.
But where was I going?
I don't know.
Oh, from the floor of Denver Comic Con 2018, I'm Gabe.
I'm Juan.
And this has been episode, I don't know which one you're listening to.
Yeah, I don't know.
This has been
This might be at the end of all of them.
It might be at the end of all of them. This has been Thinking Outside the Long Box, Denver Comic Con edition. We love you guys.
See you next year.
Join us on Patreon at patreon.com/TOTLB to get exclusive videos of our interview with DMC from Run DMC and Daryl Makes Comics, and also with a panel
press conference
with Kevin Eastman.
Yes.
That Keith Shimabukuro was so kind to step in.
Wow, you said that perfect.
I know. I've been
practicing. Usually say Keith Shimabukuro.
Keith Shimabukuro, thank you so much. Make it made me say it three times. I fucked it up. Thank you so much for sitting in while I went to Pride with my kid.
Yeah.
Definitely check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/thinkingoutsidethelongbox. Yeah. It's been a great con. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.